The Bob Murphy Show, episode 30.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome back, folks, to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. We are continuing the respite in my series on capital interest theory. I wanted to give you guys something lighter before we go into part three of that series. And so we're joined today by Robbie the Fire Bernstein. He is the host of the podcast Run Your Mouth. Many of you probably know him, though, as the co-host. And in the episode, I rib him a little bit, saying he's more of a sidekick to Dave Smith on Dave's podcast, Part of the Problem. And so we talk a lot about that as well. What we're doing in this particular episode, in case it's not clear, I really am fascinated by the world of stand-up comedy. When some children were little, they would imagine being in the World Series, you know, and their team's down by three and bases are loaded, that sort of thing. That's not what I would do. I would see George Carlin on stage and think, wow, maybe one day I could do that. And so that's why I'm so fascinated. So we spend a lot of time talking to Robbie about that, as he is a professional comedian in New York, along with Dave. Also, by the way, let me just mention, Part of the Problem is arguably my favorite podcast right now. And it's because Dave and Robbie are professional comedians that gives them the liberty to say things that other people can't get away with, both because you can get away with more if you're funny about it. So a comedian has that advantage, but also that being a stand-up comedian, it's sort of you're expected to have loony views, right? So you have a bit, you know, the jester's allowed to make fun of the king because he's funnier, but also because that's sort of his role and no one's going to take it too seriously. Whereas the head of the exchequer comes in and says, our majesty has been embezzling funds. Well, then that's different. Hope you enjoy it. And at some point when I get back into my office, don't worry, I will continue and finish the series on capital and interest theory in the Austrian tradition. But for now, enjoy Robbie the Fire. If you don't like the stand-up comedy stuff, you can skip ahead. At some point, Robbie and I do transition to talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and one way that the right-wingers who hate her guts might be doing the same mistake that the left did with Trump. So hope you like it. Welcome, everybody. As I said in the introduction here, we are joined by Rob Bernstein, but I think of him as Robbie the Fire. And Rob, just so you know, because you, how would you know? You know, you might not be following my podcast with bated breath. Your episode here that I'm doing with you is running in the midst of me doing a three-part series, each episode of which is well over an hour, talking about my doctoral dissertation on capital and interest theory. So I thought the people, they need some respite from that. Why don't we bring on a comedian? So just so you know, that's part of the role you're playing here. It's literally comic relief.
No, I was actually following it, and I was hoping that we could delve right into it because there were a couple things I thought you had a little bit wrong. And so if I could just hop in from having listened to the last one, no. Happy to be here, give some comic relief. And Robbie the Fire, I love that nickname. And I'm also, just so you know, I'm a part of the Mises Caucus, also known as King of the Cocks. That is one of my titles, and so...
Oh, okay. That's funny because I heard Dave recently... I already would have said this in the introduction. People know, you know, your connection if they don't listen. But it's funny because I was, of course, going to ask you, where did Robbie the Fire come from? And then lately I noticed that, yeah, Dave has been calling you that, and I didn't know if I should bring that up. But okay, there is a sort of, we can, you know, be coy about it and say, no, we're not saying anything dirty. He's part of a caucus. That's where that title comes from. So that is literally where that came from?
Yeah, people.
The Mises Caucus?
Exactly. Okay. People have recognized my contribution to the liberty movement, and some of them even want to call me the king. And so, you know, abbreviated, just King of the Cocks.
Okay. Speaking of which, we were mentioning before we started recording here, folks, that I was, you know, on Dave's podcast and, of course, Robbie in general, they have some salty language. They're men of the people. They don't put on airs. And so he was asking me, like, what's the ground? So I said, well, you know, technically the way I classify my thing on iTunes is there's no vulgarity and they get pretty upset if something slips through. So we're going to have to. So I said, do what you want, but it's just more work on our end. We got to bleep you. You said that was kind of fun. So that's, I don't know, you want to spend a minute? Just you move in different circles, dialects, if you will.
Absolutely. No, I mean, I live in New York City. New York City is an aggressive town. But then also just the people I hang out with. I've worked in sales office, which sales offices are almost like even more filthy than your typical comedians. And then comedians by trade, we're kind of trying to pick up vulgar language just to kind of get a rise or laugh. And some of us, not all of us, but it's definitely sometimes we're being poetically vulgar. And then you end up in, you know, pleasant company, like even my own mother or grandparents, mm-hmm. and you're around them and you just start suddenly self-filtering a little bit and just realizing like, my God, I have the world's filthiest mouth. I even had that when I was trying to find episodes that you could maybe check out of the podcast. I was just like,
right.
How are we even putting this out there? It's like, sometimes it starts off and like, we think we're going to talk politics and it just goes filthy so quickly. And I don't know, it was a lesson for me of, wow, we are really just garbage people, but you know, we're going to try today.
And even to clarify there, if I understand you, you don't merely mean there's swearing involved. You mean like the thing you're talking about itself is a naughty subject sometimes.
Yeah. We go off the rails. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So you like even more obscene than talking about the naive productivity theory of interest.
Yes.
Like you're saying. Like it's,
yes.
It's even more shocking and revolting and like cover the kids' ears and eyes. Are you kidding me? Naive productivity theory? All right. Speaking of that, this just popped into my head. I meant to ask Dave this. So there's this, it came out a few years ago where they had this compilation of famous professional comedians. And they're saying, oh, we all tell this one joke. And like, we just try to outdo each other and being more and more vulgar and obscene. Is that a real thing?
That was the Aristocrats, right?
Right. Is that a real thing? Or was that just a big joke and you guys are all laughing at the idiot public who, like, you just made that up?
Right. So I think that is, okay. There are no jokes in New York City that everyone just tells and everyone will go up on stage to see who can do a better version of that joke. Now, I actually kind of like that game. I saw that movie and it was funny and I kind of, so that doesn't
can
exist.
Can we stop you? Yeah. For people who have no clue, can you just very briefly bring people up to speed with the premises?
So it was a movie put out years ago. It was called The Aristocrats. And the reason why they made that movie is because, firstly, it's an old famous vaudeville joke of family goes into a talent agency and they ask him, hey, what's your talent? And then they go on to describe the worst things ever. Like they go, well, the mom sleeps with the daughter, then the daughter sleeps with the brother, then we'll chop off the arms, we'll get everything really bloody. And it just goes on. You get to use your own imagination and describe the filthiest thing ever. And then the punchline is finally, what do you call the act? We call it the Aristocrats. So that's the joke. But the joke is just in how filthy you can be in terms of describing.
And I keep hearing Gilbert Gottfried. Well, see, what I do is first I pull my pants down. You know.
So, but what Gilbert did that was so legendary was when they were doing the roast of, I think it might have been Hugh Hefner. It was right after 9/11. And post 9/11, people were almost, there were a lot of things. Oh, this guy taught the nation how to laugh again. Or Howard Stern was saying, hey, I was the one guy who got back on the radio the next day. But I mean, I wasn't doing comedy then. I was only in eighth grade, but apparently it was weird to get back to just doing people's jobs. And it was particularly weird to go back to being an entertainer. So Gilbert Gottfried is up at the roast and he's telling jokes and he's just bombing. It's just, it's not going well. And he is one of the best at just kind of being poetically vulgar. So he just hops into the Aristocrats joke. And I mean, that's like vaudeville. It's before my time. So I guess even 20 years ago, I guess those comics were more aware of that joke. And so everyone just thought it was the silliest thing ever that he did it. And then they made that documentary where everyone got to take a stab at that joke. But no, that would be like a fun show if like people just did old school street jokes and kind of made their own flavor on it. I almost think it lacks. Every time I go to see a band, sometimes like some of my favorite songs are covers. It doesn't exist in comedy. I almost think it would be fun if there was more of that. Like specifically, hey, I'm going to cover my favorite jokes from whoever. You know, Bill Cosby, he can't do his jokes anymore. He's in jail for being a rapist, but maybe someone else could start doing some of those.
Right. I had this, shoot, I wish if I knew we were going to go down this road, I would have remembered and jogged my memory better. I had this idea. There's this guy, Steve Miller from from the Liberty Movement, who had done some really, pretty funny stand-up material. And I had this idea one time, if he and I were ever at an event together, where we were going to do a modern version of Who's On First, but it would be like we would, it had something to do with like, we were working with Dick Cheney and we were going to do something about like the Middle East, and it was, and but it escapes me now, unfortunately, but it would have been really clever, Rob, if I could.
It sounds like a good bit. I'm in for it.
I'm trying to remember what it was now, but it was something.
Was it called Who's Bombing Brown People?
No, it was more subtle than that. See, you're all about shock value,
Robbie.
Darn it, I wish I could remember, but yeah, it was something because like the names were changing, and so it was like how the, you know, our allies were the same thing as the terrorist. It was something like that, but it was the same structure of who's on. We just kept coming back to, oh, freedom fighters, you know, like the same, you know, how he kept going, oh, first base or something. So anyway, but it was the same structure. Like one of us was the, in other words, because the premise of that is the one guy saying something very matter-of-factly and straightforward, but yet is absurd. And the other guy is like, you know, very demonstratively trying to make sense of it and just keeps getting all flustered. And that's why it's so funny. And so that's what the thing, like one, the straight guy was going to be explaining US foreign policy and the other guy keeps trying to make sense of it and, you know, and just keeps getting flustered because it's so absurd. So anyway, that was the idea, but it was going to be clearly patterned on Who's On First. But anyway, that was just among many projects I have. I got a lot of balls in the air, Rob. So, But just to confirm then, so to finish that train of thought, you're saying that as far as you're, it's not a thing now. It's not like anytime comedians are sitting around an apartment, they all say, "Hey, let's do Aristocrats." All right, and they high five each other and go into it.
I haven't been to that party yet, but maybe I'm just not being invited. You know?
I caught myself and I was gonna say I didn't want to like be too aggressive up front, but be like, is it possible, Rob, that you just haven't made it yet?
It could be that
Seinfeld, like, you know, calls off Bill Burr. He's like, no, don't tell Rob that. He's not in the club.
I hope you're right. I hope that there's some boys club out there that I don't know of. And at some point I'll reach that level to give me a nice jacket and invite me to tell old jokes. That'd be fun.
To be like, the kid's the king of the cock.
He knows where he's going. What? These people, they're not tuned into the Liberty movement yet. So they don't understand quite that I'm the king and how many followers I have and the change I'm trying to bring to the world. But we'll get there.
Yes, we will. Okay, so why don't I, as we've alluded to here, and people who heard me when I had Dave on, they probably were all expecting me to talk about Yemen. I was like, oh no, we're talking about stand-up comedy. Again, for the listeners here, this is, you know, how some kids dream about being, you know, we're in the World Series, it's the last game, we're up and we're down by three, bases are loaded, you know. That's not what I used to watch Carlin and think, if I ever just didn't care about what people thought of me, I could do that. But I do care and I fear rejection, so that's why I'm not a professional stand-up. So can you just, so this stuff fascinates me. So did you, first of all, explain to the people the sense in which you are and are not a professional comedian?
Oh, okay. That's a fair
You're like
question.
Schrodinger's comedian. Yeah.
That's the career I'm going for. I've been doing stand-up comedy in New York for probably 8 years now, and I'm competitive. I just try and get up every night, always work on material and get better and better. You know, I hope that there will be a day in the future where I make most of my income from stand-up. That's not current landscape for me, but pretty soon me and Dave are going to be out on the road, and I hope at some point to have a really great hour of comedy that I can put out for people. But yeah, man, I get up every night, and that's the way, that's my religion, is just get as funny as possible and keep getting up, keep getting better.
Now let me, and I'm sure some people in the audience are wondering, and I'm being serious here, I'm just genuinely asking, are you getting paid, or it's like open mic and anybody can come up here and you can work out material?
So luckily I've graduated from the open mic level. I did open mic for years. Not like I do open mic for years where it was just, hey, show up. Like, you had to actually buy a drink. I can't tell you how much money I spent doing open mic. It's like the world's worst career path of show up. We'll let you on stage if you buy a drink. And then 3 years later, you're like, oh my God, I've done this every night for 3 years and I'm an alcoholic. I don't know who thought of that system, but that's the way it works. So I don't do a lot of open mic anymore because I've just in my head kind of graduated from that. So I get up I get up at a lot of the clubs in New York City on guest spots, which are kind of like, well, they'll put people up and then you get to do free labor. But what's nice about free labor is you don't really care if they fire you. So you get to really experiment and work on stuff and get better. And then, you know, when I can, I book shows on the road and then you get paid for those. And, you know, it becomes a thing. Like over the course of time, you build more connections. And then at some point, you know, you're on the road every week and that's your job.
Okay, so let me just probe this further, because again, yeah, I'm hoping at least three other listeners out there are as interested in this as I am. But you know what? It's my podcast. So I'm wondering, I'll tell you what the pattern was like in karaoke. And so it's a similar thing that I used to love doing karaoke. And then
is there a karaoke circuit?
Oh, yeah. And so, and it's interesting. So I'll tell you a bit about it, because I know you're dying to know. But it sounds like there's some
what's
overlap.
Your song? I know I'm interrupting you, but I need to know, what are the Bob Murphy hits?
I'm glad you made it plural, because when people ask me, what are you open? And like, to me, that's funny, because it's like, no, it totally depends on the crowd and what they've heard up to that point, what the vibe of their, you know, if it's a bunch of drunk frat guys, it's one kind of thing. If it's an older crowd, you know, Frankie Valli. So,
oh, that's a level of mastery.
Robbie, who are we talking to here? On my phone, I have lists of the different karaoke places and which tracks are good and which ones, oh, don't do Mac the Knife at this place because they have a crappy arrangement. So don't ever do that. I have a list on my phone of that stuff.
There must be some.
Yeah, I will tell you. I'm not dodging the question. Yeah. I'll tell you. Okay, so.
Okay.
The one that's pretty safe now, like, especially if it's a younger crowd, I do a surprisingly good Eminem Lose Yourself.
Okay.
Like I got third, the first Contra Cruise, it was just a ship-wide karaoke contest. So it wasn't restricted to our group, just everybody who was a passenger ship. They had a karaoke contest. I took third place on the whole ship doing that song. And afterward, like, you had to qualify, and I qualified doing, what did I do? I think I probably did Frankie Valli, Just Too Good to Be True, you know, Can't Take My Eyes Off You. Okay. And so the guy thought, oh, he's a middle-aged guy. He's going to be a crooner doing 60s classics. Okay. And then in the finals, I get up there and I just do Eminem. And we had a big group there and they all went nuts, of course. And the judges were like, whoa. You know, like the only thing they could, because one guy was being like Simon Cowell. All he could do was make fun of me for being fat.
Like he had nothing. You know what I mean? That's all he did, was like, well, an overweight Eminem, but, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah.
And the host... It was, I can't remember the guy's act. He like had some Caribbean. He goes, the Bob Murphy that you just heard here was not the one who qualified. And what he meant was, the kind of person we thought we were putting up here for you in the mix of the finalists was, you know, this was totally different. So anyway, that's my pretty safe song. But if it's an older crowd, I know a bunch of 60s songs. I could, you know, Hang On Sloopy. Do you know that one?
That's
I do well. There's some football team that now uses that as their, like, you know, their song at halftime or something like that, because I've noticed certain college kids get that. So anyway, it's been resurrected. I do Beatles songs. I do Billy Joel. I'm pretty good. If there's like a bachelorette party, I do Footloose. Okay. I like that one.
Can you do the dance again, also? Do you got the moves?
I need to work on that. That's my Achilles heel, is I'm pretty good, you know, the vocals and everything, but when there's a musical interlude, like, for example, Aha, Take On Me, I can hit that. Well, I haven't done it in a while. I can hit that back in my prime. Like, I could totally, I wasn't bluffing. Like, I could hit it. But you know how there's the long, dun, 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 you know, the part like in the video when, like, that's a cartoon and they're running around and it's like different. And so it's a long break. And so if I'm up on stage, you need to be doing something. And I was never very comfortable doing something while it's just the musical going, you know. So maybe
we should write a musical for you. Monetary Policy, the musical. It could be a tragedy of the invention of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The feds are gonna take your wealth tonight.
Do you have any originals? Do you play like an instrument also?
I don't play an instrument, no. I do
you got the chops.
I don't want to put you on the spot. But yeah, sure. The intro music to my podcast, that's me singing.
Nice.
That's an original song I did with Dan Hagen.
The beginning of that sounds a little bit like the first chords on that sound a little like Grateful Dead's Dark Star before it kind of like hits the second tune. You know what I mean?
I would need to go. I've listened to a bunch of Grateful Dead.
I like your song.
I thought you were going to say it's but you ripped them off, Bob. Come on.
It comes in with some good chords and it's
I'm the Vanilla Ice of the Liberty Movement. Have you ever heard Vanilla Ice defend when they said he ripped off Under Pressure? And he goes, no, Under Pressure is like
I'm saying I like the flavor of the song. It comes in well.
I appreciate that.
Okay, so anyway, that was a long digression of narcissism.
What I was trying to say though is
I'm like you, that I used to love doing the karaoke bar, and then now that I do have done stuff with a live band, karaoke to me is like, you know, oh, that's just for peasants, and it doesn't excite me as much because it's
You graduated from it.
Right, exactly. So there's that element. But what I did notice too is
the karaoke bar scene evolved over time. In the beginning, it really was awful. Like, it was just drunk kids getting up and, you know, just being horrible. Like it was entertaining because they were so bad. But then there were a few people that could actually get up and sing, and then everybody would have their, you know, one or two songs that were pretty good at, and then they would just practice it. And so after a while, there was sort of a weeding out mechanism where, you know, somebody who was really bad wouldn't get up to sing, because even though they're all amateurs, there were three or four people in a row who were pretty good, especially because that was like their one song they've been practicing for months and refining, because, oh, that's my go-to karaoke bar song. And so I'm wondering, with the open mic night thing, is it like that too, that technically, even though anybody can get up there, after a while, it's like, you know, if someone gets up there and does the 4 minutes of material they've been working on for 6 months, it's actually not half bad?
Yeah, so in the open mic scene, firstly, there's a pressure to write a lot because it's a lot of the same comics that are showing up all the time. So you really only have 1 week or even 3 days to work on a new joke. Because after, like, if you're just hitting up a whole bunch of mics, if you're really being disciplined, by the fourth or fifth day, everyone in that room has heard that joke before. And so you can't get any feedback on it. So there's a lot of pressure. You know, you got to, like, almost come up with new material every week that you're working on in the open mic, which is actually not ideal for comedy, because when you really want to build bits, you want to be able to do the same bit a lot so you can kind of expand on it. And the open mic doesn't allow for that at all. It's a little bit more of like throwing darts, where it's like, is it a perfect joke that it works? Great, let's move on to the next joke, which is not the best way to kind of develop comedy material. But what you're talking about in terms of kind of weeding people out is, if you're really bad at comedy, like if you're just really bad, you know, everyone's showing up to the same mics, the people just kind of start walking out of the room or ignore. You kind of get iced, but I've seen people overcome that. Comedians are a certain special breed of sicko that they just keep showing up no matter how. I had that also. It's not like the other people at open mic particularly loved me or my comedy when I was doing it, but you just keep showing up and you suffer through it and you get better.
That's interesting, because I guess that's one huge difference then. So basically you just politely said, no, Bob, actually your analogy doesn't work at all. But or the reason it doesn't, I didn't even think of this until you just said that, is, yeah, if I hear somebody do, especially if it's an obscure song, like if I hear someone do like a song from the 70s at one karaoke bar, I'm like, oh yeah, I love this song. And especially if the guy, you know, nails it. And then I'll see that guy at a different karaoke bar. I talk in the present tense. This is like years ago when I was in Nashville and I used to go out all the time. And I would even go up to the guy and ask him and be like, hey, you know, if you don't mind, can you do that song again? Whereas I don't imagine someone sees you and you're like, oh, dude, that thing you did about the Taliban, that was a riot. Get up there and do that joke again. I want to hear you tell that again.
Yeah. Jokes are so different than music in that, like, you know, some of my favorite songs, I've listened to them 1,000 times. Jokes, for the most part, you hear them once. That, like, you see someone do their hour of comedy, that's it. You don't go see them doing the same hour again.
Right.
Or it's very rare. There's some very special jokes out there that, like, you actually want to see the bit again, but it's rare. It's a different thing. It's like you hear it once, you got the thrill out of it, you know where the shocking parts are, you know the surprises, and you got to move on.
Yeah, the only exception I can think of that is, I knew this guy, Nelson Nash, who recently passed away, and he had some joke, and he was this older guy with a really thick Southern accent, very charming Southern gentleman kind of thing. And he would tell some joke. And when I would see him in a new environment going into a joke I'd heard him tell 10 times before, I loved it, because I was just waiting for the new people to see it just so they could enjoy it too. Like, that's the only thing. But you're right. I mean, once you hear it, you know, it's like you go see a movie or something. And after that, at the first one, you can go back and watch it, but it's certainly, the initial thrill.
I got two karaoke questions for you. First one is, did you have a karaoke crew?
No.
Like, did you have a crew?
No,
I know that you sung your own songs, but I'm like, did you have a, like, were you just a free spirit? You'd show up to the bar alone? Or did you have like a pack of people with your matching leather jackets? You'd show up, take over the scene?
Okay, so good question. It depends. Again, I have to give you a nuanced answer.
Yeah.
Whenever I would go out and like speak somewhere, there would be people that, you know, who would say, obviously, especially on the younger side, but, oh, we going out and doing karaoke tonight. You know, so we'd be in some other city. So there we would roll into a place with like 10 of us and we would usually take it over. So that would happen. But when I was in Nashville, no, actually, I mean, if I was going to go out, I would sometimes try to drum up interest. But no, I actually often would prefer going by myself, because that's where I would try out new songs.
I get
and
that.
To see, like, can I hit this? Does it work well? Does the crowd like it? Because I like a lot of older songs, and so I needed to know, you know, some song that I thought was great that Neil Diamond did or something. Like, did the crowd even know this song? Are they like, what the heck is this?
Yeah,
so I would try out a lot of stuff on my home court before then going on the road with it.
You don't want to bomb in front of your own friends. So you go out in front of strangers, right. You see if you got a hit, and then when you go out with your pals, yes. You can really impress them. All right. Now, I also know that you live a Christian lifestyle, and so I'm sure when you date, it's, you know, in the way that the Lord appreciates that. But is the karaoke scene a good way of meeting women? Was that like a part of what went on, or not so much? It was more the thrill of the singing.
It was, let's see. So I was not single and available for when most of that happens. So, but yes, it definitely would be if that would have helped someone like me, cause I'm, you know, kind of shy and stuff. So yeah, I would not be good. For example, I'm not good at just like, oh, there's some group of girls over there. Let's just go up there and start talking to them. Like, to me, that was just like, it's so obvious and everything. Like, no matter what you say, they know why you're going and talking to them. It's not, oh, I noticed this handbag you had and I'm wondering, is that a, you know, no, that's not why you're asking, you know. So to me, I always get self-cut. But what I could plausibly is if someone from their group could sing and I wanted to do a duet, because there were a couple of duets that I had that were good. You know what I mean? So then I could go and just and say quite sincerely, hey, do you know this song? You know, can I put our names down? And we so that would be a good way to break the ice if that's what you're asking. So
that makes sense. But I like it.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's really good at that walk. You got to be a particular kind of handsome for the just walk over with no reason.
What are you trying to say, Rob?
What? No, I mean,
so
I think you could have pulled it off. I'm saying I also got that shy bone. I'm not just walking over to groups of women. You need a reason or purpose. You got to talk about a duet or, you know, some cause you're working on or something.
Yeah. Taxation's theft, whatever. Yeah. Okay. So, how then, like at what point did you know, oh yeah, I gotta go into comedy?
So I started doing open mic. I want to say I started doing open mic in college and I just fell in love with it. Prior to that, like even in high school, I was really interested. I didn't watch a lot of stand-up comedy growing up. Like most people, you know, like they were obsessed with stand-up comedy. I wasn't. I was obsessed with like funny movies and I loved Howard Stern and I loved radio. I loved O&A. I used to listen to them like driving into school. So I loved entertainment, and I would say
that's
probably,
Opie and Anthony, right?
Yeah, Opie and Anthony.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, dude, that used to be the best. I used to drive into school listening. I got thrown out of the dorm at one point. I dormed in high school. I got thrown out of the dorm, and then I used to drive into school. And you're not from New York City, but the Cross Bronx Expressway, legendary traffic. I mean, like next level traffic. And I used to sit there every single morning. I'd eat a muffin, listen to Opie and Anthony, and I'd be missing prayer services at school. And I'd be like, this is the best traffic jam ever. I love traffic. That would be,
by the way, I went to NYU and my mom's side of the family is from Long Island. So
so you know New York?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. When you were down in the village, did you hang out at the Cellar at all? You were right there. You were in the heart of where some good comedy was going on.
You know, I'll tell you a quick one. And I realize in retrospect what I did wrong, but I went there with, I think, with girlfriend at the time, and we're sitting in the front row. I'm not saying it was a comedy slot. I don't remember what it was, but it was one of those village, you know, comedy places. And the people, and this one guy got up there and he was, I don't know what it was, but for some reason I was just in a surly mood and we were right in the front and my girlfriend was like really dolled up at the time, and so like the comedian were all like, I'm sure we stood out, in other words, you know, and so they would remark it, and you know how the shtick of that would normally go, like the guy on stage, you know, complimenting her and like, you know, ripping on me kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I was just stone faced.
Yeah.
And I just, for some reason, I was just in a bad mood, and I was just, you know, I wasn't being aggressive. It was the kind of thing where the guys on stage were like, and like there were some like really tough black guys in the back. And I was like, is there anybody, you know, you know, I'm making fun of this guy, but he looks like he's one of the, you know, like serial killer face. Is there anyone's got my back? And like, you know, the black guys, like, yeah, we got you, bro, you know, kind of thing. So I realized later that me sitting there not breaking a smile was probably a pretty aggressive, you know what I mean? When you're up on stage and someone right in the front is just looking at you, like letting you know, I don't find you entertaining whatsoever. That's pretty... That can mess up your game. Am I right in saying that? Like, that's, at the time, I just thought I'm sitting here minding my own business, but I realized that was probably pretty, of an affront.
No, well, I think in comedy, you have to control the room. And so if you engage with somebody, you kind of have to walk away with some funny. And sometimes I'm very good at crowd work. I don't like to do it. I prefer to work on my jokes, but my crowd work game is kind of, if people aren't laughing at my jokes, I'll start going after people in the crowd. And what I'm kind of telling them is, hey, you guys have two choices here. You can listen to my jokes or I'll start making fun of you. And let me tell you, that gets people to start sitting up in their seats, listening and laughing at your jokes. It's kind of just a way of controlling the room. So in that interaction, the guy didn't care. He wasn't taking it personally. But once you start engaging with the table, you can't, it's like a bit of a battleground. You just can't lose the interactions. I can't have some guy who's mopey, you know. Also, the other thing is I kind of have ADD and I know other people like this. Sometimes when you're on stage killing, it's hard not to notice the one person not having fun and be like, dude, what's your problem? Like, why aren't, you know, and it's like, there's no reason for that. Just leave the person alone. But sometimes when you're on stage, like you just got that momentum and you're like, I'm going to bully this guy into liking me too. No one's walking out if you're without loving me. It's not going to happen.
Right.
But back to your question. Back to your question.
I was going to say, that guy certainly didn't love it. But yes, I mean, in retrospect, it was, I was unnecessary. I'm just saying it was a bad experience. Like I thought, oh, we're going to go have a good time. I love comedy. And it blew up in my face. Like I walked out of there pissed off, but I had a lot going on at the time. And you know, so
yeah,
I think I walked in there with some baggage.
But, I got you. Oh, I'm sorry that happened.
And it was not, I mean, the other thing too was it was, and I think I was mentioning this to Dave, like when you, cause I even saw Carlin, not, and this isn't the time of course, but I mean, what you see when they do their HBO special is like the pinnacle when they've refined all the bugs out and everything. When you just see them working a college crowd or something, it's not to that level of refined perfection. And so I was picturing like, oh yeah, let's go see some live comedy in New York. And I thought it was going to be like when you see stuff on TV, and it wasn't that good at all. So I think that's partly, I was sitting there like, are you kidding me? This is, you guys get, you know, you're professional comedians and this is how much you suck. Like that's kind of the attitude I had too. So,
well, the flip side of that, I can tell you, when you go to like the New York City showcase clubs, sometimes, firstly, sometimes people are working their tight stuff and you get to kind of see like five people working their 15 minutes of best jokes. And then sometimes when people are working on new stuff, sometimes there's I don't know, it's a live performance thing. So, it is a little bit like flipping a coin, but sometimes you go there live and people are working on stuff and it's magic. Like I can't tell you how many times I've been in a room working on material and it was killing. And it's stuff that you'll never hear again because it just didn't connect. It didn't have a high percentage of enough of connecting that I made it a part of the act. But there were nights where that bit murdered and people loved it. And no one's ever going to experience that. Or like there's been times that, you know, the show wasn't that good and I just kind of started talking to people and you start just telling a story or things go off the rails. So there's a lot to be said for the, in my opinion, the showcase clubs and the not people just doing like their HBO specials.
Okay. Very interesting. And you... So you mentioned something there, and I think this is a good time to go into it, where sometimes something hits and other times like, and again, just to make a karaoke analogy, I've had it where, you know, how I said I test market stuff and I would go and do it. And, or another thing that would happen is sometimes I'd see somebody get up and do a song that I always liked, but I wasn't sure how it would go over, and just the crowd loved it. And so I would jot a note down on my phone like, oh, next time it's appropriate, let me do that song. It works. And then I would get up there and do it and it wouldn't work. And, you know, you didn't know, it was just the crowd's different. Was that guy a little bit more confident in selling it? Because that's the thing too with karaoke, like you have to sell it. Dude, it has to be total commitment. If you get up there and there's any ounce of, oh my gosh, do these people like this song or not? You're just dead. Like it's, you know what I mean? So, and I've noticed that with, obviously in comedy, it's probably even more so, because at least with music, if you're hitting the notes and stuff, that's still enjoyable, especially if it's a popular song people like. They just want to sing along with it. But you get what I'm saying? Like somebody will get up there and do it, an older song, and everyone's singing along with them and getting into it. And other, you can get up there and do the same song, not screw it up. You know, your timing's right. You're hitting the notes and just crowd's not into it. They're all going to the bathroom, getting more drinks or whatever, trying to, you know, hit on the group of girls down the other end of the bar. And so anyway, you found that too, that it's just, there's some spontaneous element. It's unpredictable.
You wouldn't believe. I mean, I have jokes that I've told now for, I don't have a lot of them, but I would say I have like five or six jokes that I've told for 7 years now, and they're perfect. Like they don't not work. Like, I have them in my back pocket. Basically, if I lose a crowd, like I'm just shuffling around in my head, I'll be like, okay, let's win them back. Let's go do this joke. even those jokes mm-hmm. sometimes, like they're dude, I've worked on them for 7 years and they have a 95% success rate, but there's still that 5%. Mm-hmm. There's still audiences that they just, sometimes audiences just don't like you. Like you literally just go up there and they just decide, you know what? We don't like this guy. And then you're up, or sometimes this happens. Sometimes the comic beforehand was like, you're so different than them. They need some time to reset. Like you got to kind of reset the room. So the answer is every crowd is different and some of the best material you can just bomb with. Like you can literally just, you know, have bits that you've worked on for years. It's your A material and just get up in front and they don't like you and they're not going to, or they're just not in the mood. Yeah. Luckily I've gotten up really late at night. I've done like, I would say a couple hundred shows by now at 2 a.m. in Times Square to like drunk tourists or 11:45 when a show was running 2 hours over. So I've kind of learned tricks of how to throw a lot of energy at the room, start yelling at people. I'll throw people out of the room. I kind of have my own way of really turning things very weird. And so luckily I, for the most part, don't bomb that often. But like sometimes I have shows where my jokes just aren't working and all the laughs kind of come from creating chaos in the room or, you know, just making fun of people in the audience. So I've learned, like, in other words, I've learned I'm a really good joke writer and I have material that works. Mm-hmm. And even so, if I hadn't picked up the other skills of how to like work a room and work the crowd, I'd have some sets where I just bombed. Like sometimes material just doesn't work for no reason other than you're never bomb proof in comedy. You're just not. Like, that's the nature of it. It's crazy.
There's something to, I think too, did you see the movie, the Billy Crystal movie? I think it was called Mr. Saturday Night.
Oh, I think I've seen like parts of it, but never the whole thing. But I've definitely seen parts of Mr. Saturday Night.
Okay, so there's a good, it's a great, so the premise is, I think you should watch it. Just my little two cents.
I love that.
Because it's a.
Yeah, I love at the beginning when he's like, which jacket's funnier? And the brother always picks out his jacket. I love that little nuance. Yeah, yeah. And then he also steals the lady from his brother. That was the other really kind of. Oh yeah, but anyways, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. So that's the movie. So yeah, so for people who don't know, it's Billy Crystal. He's playing like a comedian, nightclub entertainer kind of guy. And the deal is, when he and his brother are growing up, they're of course the clowns of the family, and they're always really funny in family interactions. And then they go to take it on stage, and right the last minute, you know, the one brother chickens out. He's like, no, our material. He's like, this is funny at Thanksgiving and stuff in front of our relatives. This isn't going to be funny for these. And so the one brother says, well, I'm going on anyway. He goes out, and so he's kind of dead in the water now because he's trying to do material that he had worked on assuming his brother was going to be. So he just goes out on the stage in front of a big crowd, and he starts bombing. And there's a guy in the crowd, I forget what he says, but some guy starts heckling him. And he's a young guy at this point, you know, in the movie. And he goes, I'm sorry, sir, who said that? And so the guy says, he goes, can you stand up, sir? And the guy gets up and he's a big guy. And he goes, whoa, it's New Jersey in pants.
And then the crowd
starts laughing and he just starts ripping on the guy for being fat. And then from that, you know, that's the turnaround. And from that point on, he becomes, you know, a famous celebrity comedian. And so what you just said there, you know, sparked it, Rob. And I had something, obviously to a much lesser degree, at Pork Fest one time. I had a bunch of prepared skits that I was doing. Like they'd give me an hour. And I think I called it the Bob Murphy special or something, or variety show. That's what I called
it.
And so I had this one bit where I do impressions. You know, they're not half bad. It's not like I would make a career out of it, but it's like, given that you're an Austrian economist and whose books I like, that impression of Michael Keaton's not half bad. It's that kind of deal. And I had someone come up to do, because I was going to do Sean Connery and, you know, in the Indiana Jones thing. So I was calling people up from the crowd to participate. And so I gave the guy a script and it was, you know, it was okay, but it wasn't like, I was starting to panic. Like it wasn't going great. And then fortunately it was just a gift from God where this kid gets up there and he couldn't read my handwriting, like the script I had written. And so he just starts saying the wrong lines. And for some reason, I think he was foreign, he started trolling me. So he started just like doing a weird accent. And so on the one hand, it was sabotaging what I was trying to do, but it was good because I just stopped and looked at him and I said, what are you doing? And the crowd just started dying. And I was like, you know, libertarians, folks, this kid's not just unschooled. He's uneducated or something like that. I just started, you know, riffing and it was very spontaneous. So I think that's the thing too, where if you get out of your prepared, like, no, I worked on this and this is going to be funny. And if it's not working, sometimes the spontaneous, like, it's like the crowd's there with you.
Yeah, they kind of, part of it is they have to buy in. They have to like sit there and go, hey, this guy's funny and I want to listen to him. And so usually you got to get up front with like a really good joke that you win them over. And sometimes that doesn't happen. Like sometimes I like to stick to the script and just kind of do my jokes. And sometimes the people before me were real off the cuff. And so they're expecting me to go up there and just talk to them. So sometimes like I got to tell 2-3 jokes and just have them not hit and just like kind of stay in the lane. And then the third one gets a giggle and then they start kind of picking up on what you're doing. But you have to win them over and get them to buy into, hey, this guy's funny, I'm going to listen to him.
Right.
What we were talking about though, with the material, and this is something I'm kind of working on right now, is me and Dave have talked about this. Like we've gotten up in front of these New York City tourist crowds, and Dave, I mean, marvelous job of taking some libertarian concepts and making them funny to a universal audience, which just is not easy to do. But there's kind of like the Jay Leno model, which is you got to get up in front of the toughest crowds, and then you forge the material that's just like, you know, if it worked here, it can work anywhere. But I'm starting to find sometimes with these drunk late night crowds, you just end up doing hackier jokes or more drug stuff or more just filthy stuff. And so I think part of it is you also want to try and elevate your game by getting in front of smarter audiences so that, that's the difference between, doing the podcast or even like some of the sketches I filmed. You're almost not beholden to making the audience laugh. So it can be more of just your artistic vision. Whereas when there's a crowd there's a relationship and that you got to entertain them because otherwise it's awkward for everybody. So that's part of the struggle is trying to get up in front of, ultimately just headlining and having your audience, but really being able to get up in front of good crowds that are smart enough to kind of get the nuance of American politics, the jokes you want to make, so you can kind of elevate, you know, the material that you're doing.
Yeah. I like that. And I certainly agree with what you're saying there. I wonder too. So yeah, you could like on your podcast or whatever, you can do a joke that it's a sort of a subtle thing, a nuanced thing where maybe 5 out of 1,000 people are going to get it, but those 5 people are going to say, that was hilarious. I get what this guy's doing. And so on the podcast, those 5 out of 1,000 people can find you over time and your audience grows. But yeah, if you're going to do it in front of a live crowd who's not there because they're buying a ticket to see you, then what are the, you know, it's only going to be 5 out of 1,000 people laughing. So that's, different audiences.
The other thing that's nice about the podcast format is you get more of an opportunity to build a premise. It's like if I'm on stage and I want to, let's say, just say theoretically I had a joke about the Federal Reserve, I have less than 1 sentence to establish whatever the source material for a joke is. Like I don't have any jokes on interest rates, but if I had a joke on interest rate and I wanted to get up in front of a late night crowd, I'd have to explain what an interest rate is. I'd have to explain how, it would be a paragraph of information before I could even get to, and here are my jokes on that source material. So what's nice about the podcast is nobody is in, it's not as urgent that you need the jokes. So you could spend some time being like, hey, I want to read you this news article. You could read the whole news article if you wanted to, and then go, here are my jokes on that. So, and that way the format's a little bit more forgiving for if you want to be doing, nuanced or heady stuff.
Yeah. And that's, I've noticed that on Twitter, for example, where I over time have built up an understanding with my actual followers where I'll retweet something and say something deadpan, like as if I don't understand what the person's point was. You know, I can't think of a good example off the top of my head, but where, you know, so people over time who've gotten my sense of humor, like they realize, okay, it can't possibly be that Bob thinks AOC is making a great point about, you know, raising taxes on the rich here. Oh, I see what he's doing. You know what I mean? But then if the problem though is if something takes off and people start retweeting it, then you get piled on. I don't mind when some progressive liberal, you know, calls me monster or whatever. But what's annoying is when I get, quote, corrected by libertarians or, you know, conservatives who don't know me that well and just think, I can't believe this guy. You call yourself an economist at the Free Market Institute and you don't know that raising taxes is bad? It's like, yeah, I'm familiar. Thank you. Yeah, it was a joke. You know, but anyway, it is sort of annoying where you think you've got the crowd and you're like, are you kidding me? Like, you can say it's not funny, but you didn't even get that was supposed to be a joke. Give me a break. You know, what are you? Is this thing on? It's that sort of deal.
Yeah.
Okay. So why don't we now? I liked you sent me ahead of time this clip. This was from your podcast, Run Your Mouth, where you're talking about the Taliban. And this, like, this made me laugh out loud. I really once. And so I see what you're saying.
I love this joke. This is a good example. I love this joke. And I think I tried it twice on stage and just crowds weren't quite like on board for it. But I think, like, to me, that those like aren't even crafted. Those are just, I did them on my podcast. That's written, go, boom, done. You know what I mean? Like, usually, yeah, at least with the stand up stuff. And what's fun about it is you get the response. And so, like, they kind of take shape over time and then, like, they develop and become better. So yeah, these are really good jokes, but the couple times I tried them on stage, at least in the crowds I was in front of, they were just like, what is he talking about?
Okay. So we'll play it right now for you folks at home here.
Years ago, I remember when the U.S. first went to war in Afghanistan, you saw these soldiers, they're out in these poppy fields.
Right.
They're not destroying it, which is crazy. Poppy, that's opium. That's fucking
heroin.
Gotta
get rid of that shit.
And they're just leaving it. It's like we're in this country and they're just leaving it, right? So anyways, I'm reading this article and this is what really caught my eye is that now they're starting to get rid of this stuff. And then, of course, in the Wall Street Journal, here was the line, the Taliban deny any connection to the drug trade. And first and foremost, I was like, is there really some representative from the Taliban that the Wall Street Journal got a hold of? And they're like, listen, we would never sell drugs, okay? We're running a legitimate terrorist organization over here. What do you think? Like, how do you like get a hold of the Taliban HR department? That they're like, drugs? What are you talking about?
It was their monthly press conference.
Exactly. Like, what have I missed in the news over the last 12 years? Like, is there a Huckabee Sanders for the Taliban that I don't know about? Doing some press conference out of a cave. Here's the proof that the Taliban was actually American run. Are you ready?
Ooh.
So first we have this very HR moment of like, hey, we would never sell drugs. But I remember from years ago when they found, when they killed Osama bin Laden, they were going through these papers. And amongst his papers, there was actually a terrorist application form, which included information like name, age, educational level, criminal history. And it's like, you know, it's like you get sick of American life. You want to go to the most extreme thing, and you're like, I'm going to go be a terrorist. And they're like, well, you're going to need a resume. Do you have a LinkedIn profile that we can check out? Like, I'm sorry. I think you're a little underqualified for this position. I'm going to go further with this. You ready? What else they asked for? The application included specific queries like, do you wish to execute a suicide operation? It's like, no, I was hoping that, like, can we just like break phone calls, like something a little lighter?
What else you got?
There's something like that's not as deathy, you know? Okay. And then here's the last one. And who should we contact in case you become a martyr? Now, the hilarious thing about that is, in case, that's like air lawyers wrote that. Like, in the unfortunate event, what is American corporate more like in case you become a martyr? Like, it's some passive activity. Like, you didn't strap on the vest yourself and pull the ripcord.
Hey, so there you go, folks. He's this, this guy, these libertarians, they're funny guys. Just kill one of them. So there, again, that's great material. And so you're saying with that one, and you're right, and that's not, someone doesn't need to know about who Milton Friedman is to get that joke. They just have to get that, oh yeah, that is totally the case. Like in a news story, the Taliban might clarify and say, we don't have anything to do. And you're right. Like the normal person though never takes it to the next level to say, wait a minute, how do they have a quote from the Taliban? What is that? Who does that?
Yeah. How do you get a hold of these people? Like, I mean, it's just such a ridiculous thing. The funnier part of that one was, I remember,
it's like Bin Laden did not respond to multiple requests for commentary.
Yeah. Like he's in a cave somewhere. Good luck getting a hold of him.
So let me ask you, I mean, was it, you read that story, obviously, like immediately did you wonder and then say, oh wait, I can make this into a joke, or what's that process?
Oh, that's a good question. So I think on that one, I mean, that one's a little bit far back, but I think right away, I would say I picked up on that right away. Like I'm reading it and they said they reached a representative from the Taliban. And so just right away in my head, the red flag of like, wait a second, what does that mean? And then once I kind of just pick up on that inconsistency of, hey, that doesn't add up, you're like, oh, well, there's a joke in there. Like that's funny that they're trying, you know what I mean? That's kind of, I would say that stage one of a joke is going, wait, there's something weird here. There's something that doesn't add up. And then it's the angles of the punchline of how you can present your argument for why that information doesn't make sense.
And so the structure, I mean, people might not like this, but I mean, if you're a professional comedian, you gotta like, and partly why I want to talk to you so much about this, Robbie, is just, I've noticed when you're with Dave on the show, you're more, what word do I want? like he knows a lot of facts. Like Dave has a very good memory. Like he kind of occasionally would say, it's crazy that, you know, morons like me and you, Rob, are up here doing a better job. But I mean, I think he undercuts himself. Like he has a shockingly good memory, like Scott Horton as well. You know, this amazing to me how many little facts Dave can be like, and then the Taliban did this. And then in Yemen, we had this, this, and this, and that kind of thing. But I think you are more analytical. Like you want to get down to the underlying principles of things, it seems, when you guys are going back and forth. Like he has a bunch of facts, whereas you're more, it seems like you've read about the philosophy or the theory behind something. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, 100% I get where you're, yes. Yeah, I would say, I'm always curious, like what are the working factors here that brought us this end result? And I would also say my knowledge on, I'm very uneducated. I mean, that's the honest truth. I didn't really show up to high school much. I failed out of college, but like, I would say.
But you heard a lot of Opie and Anthony. So.
Yeah, well, that's true. I did enjoy that on the drive in, but I would say I'm a little bit more curious than other people as to like, what are just the factors that are, you know, what's going on here? So I think that's probably what you're picking up on is just my curiosity or thought process there.
Right. And so that's why, just for the people, that's why I'm grilling you so much and I'm going so slowly, perhaps agonizingly so, over just like, why is this funny? So the process there, you notice that there's something a little off. So you get the underlying premise, but then in order to make it a joke, it's not enough just to notice the connection. You need to like come up with not that what I just did was, you know, hilarious, but I mean, even there, like where you and I had the premise and then I brought up, oh, like, you know, Bin Laden could not be reached for comment. You know what I mean? Like it's a specific application of the general premise. And so is it just you kind of play with like, what's the, you know, the thing that gives the most punch that immediately illustrates to the listener, this is the premise of what I'm trying to do here. Do you get why that's weird? Let me illustrate to you how ridiculous this is. And so you kind of just exaggerate it a little bit beyond what the thing is that you noticed.
Great question. So I would say like there are multiple. All right. Well, first, let me say this as a caveat. I think comedy at its best is when you get away from the structures and you're just so naturally funny that people almost can't pinpoint what you're doing that's funny. With that being said, most of the jokes I tell are not that. There's structure behind it. One of the structures that we're kind of alluding to right now is really my favorite and cleanest. And I send you a couple examples that are in this format. But it's what I call, it's just premise punchline. It's like, I got a funny idea. Now, what's a punchline that conveys that information in a funny way? And it almost becomes like writing proofs. Like here, I just have like a good example is if you listen to Part of the Problem podcast, a couple, it might've been two episodes back. I was talking about how I think I should be able to get in front of a judge and just explain the fact that I'm lazy and that's why I'm not doing my taxes.
Right, like, yeah, I did hear that bit,
I should just be let off the hook because it's not an aggression against the government or it's not that I don't want them to take my wealth. It's just I'm really lazy and I don't want to deal with it. And then the punchline becomes, well, what kind of physical proof can I show up with to show how lazy I am? So that kind of becomes the punchline. Right. Like, hey, I'm going to show up and I'm going to drop in front of the jury all my laundry. You know, like there's six months of laundry in this room. Like you expect a guy with six months of laundry. So that kind of becomes like the premise is just the
you guys actually said dirtier stuff on the show.
Dave came up with the better punchline. Yeah. But that's kind of the idea. It's like you got your premise, which is like, all right, I've got like this funny angle here. And now what can I say that's so specific that's going to elicit a laugh?
Okay.
Which becomes like writing proofs almost.
Right. Yes. So I do want to listen to those other ones to see more illustrations of that. But do you have any further comments on, so that, you know, you talking there, that was hilarious to me, but you're saying that particular, you tried what we just listened to in front of a live crowds and it just never really.
Yeah, man, that one just did not connect. I think the first half of that joke connected, how did you reach someone? The problem with that joke, it was like I was saying before, there was too much premise. People aren't up on the news. They don't know about the Taliban. They don't know about the opium fields that the U.S. Army just left behind. There's a few too many intangibles that the audience doesn't know about. You kind of have to spend a little bit too much time explaining it to them for the payoff. Now, that's in my experience. It could be like someone who's a little bit more masterful could make that one work. But that was, I must have tried. To me, it's a perfect joke. And I tried it like, not a perfect joke, but that thing was solid. And it was like three strikes are out. I think I tried it three times, just didn't quite connect. And we're like, all right, forget this one.
Huh. Interesting. Because they really don't need that much. But yet, in order to make sense of, in other words, the only real premise is the New York Times saying, or I don't know if it was the Times or some other thing, you know, saying, yeah, okay, the journal saying the Taliban position on this was such and such.
Right.
But you're right. In order to even like, you have to kind of give them a little bit more of the backdrop just so they understand the tale of it. Because it's not enough just for them to be quick. Because you could say, you know, why is the U.S. the great Satan? And the Taliban spokesman said such and such. And that's not as funny because it has to be, they were not only responding to the journalist's inquiry, they were trying to show, oh, we're not the bad guys you're making us out to be. We're just mere terrorists.
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know, that was the premise of your joke. So I guess, yeah, you're right. They did need some more information. And yeah, they're drinking and, you know, the last guy was talking about, you know, the dating scene. And then you get up there and try that joke. I could see why maybe that was a bit highbrow.
Yeah, I also think that one might come a little bit out of left field because you're also introducing to people the fact that, you know, this terrorist organization is actually U.S. run. And even though they're like the punchlines there to support it, I think that's the kind of stuff sometimes, you know, people are just like, I don't want to hear about this. We're here to laugh. What are you talking about?
Right.
But, you know, it's a guessing game. I wish we could pull the audience after every single one, after every joke even. Be like, so I noticed you laughed at this and not that one. Was there a reason why?
Okay, so some more example, and just for the backdrop, folks, I had asked Rob to, you know, give me examples of some professional comedians doing jokes, just again for him to instruct us. So the point here isn't, oh, these are Rob's all-time favorite jokes. This is more just he's trying to teach us this principle of you call it premise punchline.
Yeah, it's because what makes you funny with your friends sometimes is like you can just throw a premise out there. You can just go like, I don't know, wouldn't it be funny if Batman came in here and just crashed our party? And I don't know, that's dumb, but like people might laugh and then people might start tagging and go, oh, not just Batman, but Rob, what do you think he really looks like in those pants or whatever? You know, people would just start,
yeah,
and you'll get a laugh. And so I think people make the mistake when they start comedy where they just have like these funny ideas, like, isn't it funny that my in-law has this annoying voice or whatever the hell it is? And what they don't realize is, well, now you have a joke premise that's worth zero in comedy world. Like, that might make you funny with your friends. It might make you funny on a podcast where you've just noticed, hey, there's this, like this funny little quirk, but without a punchline, you're dead in the waters. It's not going to work on stage.
Right.
So you got to recognize, all right, well, I got my funny idea. Now, how do I kind of put it into the language of funny where an audience is actually going to laugh at that? And that's where you kind of actually need a punchline or what, you know, in this style of comedy, which I really like, where it's like, hey, I've got my funny example. I got my funny concept. Now I'm going to prove it. Here's the perfect example. And the two jokes I sent your way are really good, you know, a really good outline for this structure.
Okay, so this first one we're going to listen to is Nick DiPaolo talking about seatbelt laws. All right, go ahead and play it.
I got pulled over recently for not wearing a seatbelt in New York City. Man, they're pulling me over. Meanwhile, Arabs are setting up shop to cut my f***ing head off. But let's pull over the comedian. I get pulled over for not wearing a seatbelt, $150 fine. Anybody else hate this law besides me? About 80 is, really? You're all for big government? Is that why Obama's winning this f***ing thing? You really want government in your car? Who am I endangering other than myself by not wearing a seatbelt? Seriously, if I go through a windshield, what am I going to continue on like a heat-seeking missile and hit a daycare center? That's not what happens. You usually end up half in the car, half on the hood, blood in your eye socket, s*** in your pants, you're a vegetable. I watch CSI. I know this stuff.
That is just the perfect joke. Firstly, it starts off with a libertarian principle, which I love, which is, does the government need to be in your car? That's kind of his statement. That's like the opening statement is, does the government really need to be in your car? And now, me and I can argue that, but then he comes up with the perfect example of why he answers his question with the perfect example that's so ridiculous that you can't not laugh, which is, like, are they, like, who else can be hurt? The only person who can be harmed here is me. Am I really going to leave my car like a heat-seeking missile and hit into a kindergarten? So what makes that work is it's just, firstly, it's hilarious. You can't not agree with him and go, oh, you're right. And just the visual of a person flying out of a car like a heat-seeking missile, it's perfect. It, like, you can't not laugh at that.
And also, though, the delivery, like, how can I put it?
Oh, he's a master.
It really helps, yeah, to have his accent and the way he's, you know, angry at the world. In other words, like, I think if I said the exact same thing, it wouldn't be as funny. Like, it really helps that it's him telling that joke.
Yeah, that comes from you just get up on stage enough and you start learning how to, you know, at first you want to just be you. And people talk about, hey, like you being honest in comedy or just finding your own voice. And I find sometimes it's you're up there and you just over time you get more and more comfortable exaggerating. And then over time you actually become an entertainer. You know what I mean? Like, you get up and you just kind of talk and it's not working. And then, you know, you just kind of sell things more and more. And then all of a sudden you sound like Nick DiPaolo, like some 1940s gangster or whatever.
Very good. All right. So now the next one we have lined up here is Eddie Pepitone. Am I saying his name right?
Yeah. And by the way, in terms of funny talking delivery, that guy, he's just got that yell hook, which is hilarious.
Yes.
He could yell about anything and it would just be kind of funny.
So he's here. Eddie Pepitone is going to be talking about the premise of Yelp, I guess. And so you folks, you'll understand quite soon what he's talking about. So here we go. I'll take a listen. You guys ready? Okay, go ahead and play it.
Thing I don't like about Yelp. Thing I don't like about Yelp is you don't know if those Yelp reviews are real. You're like, did some who works in this restaurant say that this place has great jalapeno papas? And we're the type of generation, we don't want to take a chance. Like, we'll go to a restaurant and we'll Google it and we'll Yelp it. And instead of just jumping in there and, you know, just throwing caution to the wind, we'll be like, check out what fucking Yelp has to say. Don't go in there, Margaret! Don't just go in there! Suppose the nachos are soggy. Suppose there's a flaw.
All right. So I just perfect joke to me. It starts off with the premise of, do we really need Yelp? It's a fair question. It's a fair criticism where it's like, do you really need Yelp? Like, and then he comes in with the observational angle of it's that you don't want to take a chance, which is interesting because now it's almost like a cost benefit analysis. Like, what's better, walking into a place and just being like, screw it, I'm going to walk in here? Or is it that like, every time before I go in there, I know it's going to be perfect. And so he's making fun of us that like, what's the real risk of going in there and taking a chance? That's really what his question is. What's the risk of going? And then he pegs words and accents that are so funny. First is, don't go in there, Margaret, just conjures up like some 1940s image of like some lady on a farm that's going to walk into a room with like the Loch Ness monster in there. And then also like suppose the nachos are soggy. And then he takes it so far as suppose there's a flaw. And that just like, I don't know, that kind of rips you into you as a human where you got to realize like, all right, yeah, we're all flawed. Like, what's the big deal? Why am I really looking at this thing on Yelp? Why not experience spontaneity and just walk in? So that the premise is like, he just has a true observation about human beings that there's a stupidity here of why not just walk into a restaurant? Why do we have to look up everything online? And then his example is just so perfect that it elicits a laugh.
Yeah, and it, because as you're saying, again, we're beating it to death here, but that's the whole point. We're analyzing why is that funny? Because you're right. It's not like you're looking up reviews of a car and like, oh wow, there's a rollover risk here, and my 2-year-old might die. It's the on Yelp, like in the generally, if someone gets a bad restaurant review on Yelp, it's not that, oh yes, I got food poisoning here, or the waiter tried to stab me. It's that the nachos were soggy.
Like that's the kind that's of, you know, the that's risk. The worst.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the kiss of death on Yelp. Yeah.
And what makes it so is he's yelling about that as if it was like a real threat. And that's what kind of pieces it all together in your brain of like, oh yeah, that's stupid of me.
Hey everybody, let's take a pause from my conversation with Robbie the Fire to let me just mention that if you are so inclined, I would appreciate it if you went to bobmurphyshow.com/contribute. Because the more of you that do so, the more time I can spend on this podcast. So, you know, you like it or you don't, but let's be real here. I'm alternating between talking about capital and interest in the Austrian tradition, and I'm interviewing Robbie the Fire, and we're talking about stand-up comedy. Say what you will, it's a fairly unique combination of topics, and I have plenty more in store. There's all kinds of places I want to go with this podcast. I just need to free up some of my time to do it, all right? So I appreciate all the contributions that have come in so far. And if you are considering, I would urge you to check it out at bobmurphyshow.com/contribute. Thanks. Okay. And then now you also sent a Doug Stanhope one, but I want to do the prescription pills one. Now that one, is it the same thing or is it a different in terms of the structure?
I would say Doug is different. And here's what I love about Doug Stanhope. Firstly, Doug Stanhope's my favorite comedian of all time. But what Doug does better than anybody is he really elevates the comedy and that, like, I mean, Dave does this also. He'll take views from a libertarian perspective and he makes jokes around it that are so good, you kind of can't not, you kind of can't not agree with him. So I'll plug some of the other jokes that we're not going to do, but he's got that joke about marriage. Like, hey, baby, what we have going on here is so good. We have to get the government in on this. It's a great, like, he's just telling you, like, well, why do you need to have government as a part of your, what do these two things have to do with each other? But he makes it funny. What Doug does really well is, I want to say there's a different joke structure of kind of creating, stating the unintended consequence as the desired reason for doing something. So, like, for example, this isn't funny, but it's like if the U.S. government were to be like, listen, we're doing taxes because we really want to hinder economic growth and expansion and make sure that no one can be prosperous. Or I'm going to take I'm lactose intolerant, so I'm going to eat this milkshake because I want to have diarrhea tomorrow. It's kind of, we all do that. It's like a form of sarcasm where you kind of just mention the unintended consequence, or it's like, I'm going to get really drunk tonight because I'm hoping to have a hangover tomorrow. I'm supposed to get together with my mom. I don't want to go, so I'm just hoping I'll be really sick. So he does a better version of that where he doesn't just take the unintended consequence. He kind of boils things down to there's really no way to say that you're doing this other than wanting that outcome. Like, for example, the government thing, he kind of boils it down to the only thing you're accomplishing by getting married by the government is having the government sanction your marriage. Now, is that really special in a romantic way? It's not. It's valueless. What does that do for you? So, I mean, you can play the bit now and then we can kind of break it down. But I'll tell you, Doug is a little bit more Eddie Pepitone and DePaulo, some of my favorite comics, and they're great, but that's like a more simple joke structure. Doug is like kind of, I want to say like, it's the wrong word to say. And I like DePaulo a lot, so I hope they never hear this. It's kind of like almost a higher level thing here where it's a little bit harder to break down, but let's give it a listen.
The only drugs that are even popular anymore, all the dummy drugs, all the drugs that make you more boring, all the mood stabilizer, antidepressant, everyone's got some mental disorder they've been diagnosed with and they take a fucking pill. They push them on me all the time. I got ruined so many relationships because I get, I think all the time. Sorry. Oh, geez. It's ADD. No, it's not ADD. I'm thinking. I'm thinking about a lot of stuff. It's not ADD. Yeah, I stutter a lot and I stuff up, but that's because I'm always thinking, well, you're not listening to me because I'm thinking about something that's more interesting than you. I'm trying to build a perfect utopian society in my head. And what are you talking to me about? Bowling or what? I have a head that just won't shut the fuck up. So where do the ideas come from? Do you have a head like that? Do you have the brain that just won't shut the fuck up all the time? You learn to work with it. Well, I'm not taking fucking medication for it. That's also where the ideas come from. I'll just pour some alcohol on that when it happens and try to even it out. You work with your problems. Fucking everyone's taking pills just because you're afraid of standing out. Or I was terrified when my doctor told me that I had a unique and interesting personality trait. But then he told me about new Zoloft and Prozac, and I just take 3 pills a day and I blend into this fucking horrible inbred corporate landscape, and I don't care. They'll legalize any drug so long as that drug keeps you producing. That's all they give a shit about is production. You're kicking out enough boxes at the plant? Well, go. It's whatever keeps you doing that. Keeps you vaguely content sitting in a cubicle. Go ahead. FDA approved. I have a job where I alphabetize insurance forms 45 hours a week, and I noticed I couldn't concentrate so well on my job, so my doctor put me on Adderall, and now I can just breeze through my workday. I don't even notice that my empty life is being pissed away underneath fluorescent tubes. I have no highs or lows. I have no good stories. But I'm getting a lot of stuff done. I'm probably the most boring person I know, but look at me produce. I just go A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, P, blah, 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 blah. You're never going to take a pill for that. You're not concentrating because that's fucking boring, and that's a natural reaction to boring. Don't concentrate.
So what makes that just a better the best stand-up is that there's some profound wisdom in there. There's a commentary on government in terms of what is and isn't legal. And, you know, there's a conversation to be had about why some drugs are legal and why are some are illegal. But then there's also a personal commentary about the way you live your life, and that he's telling you, like, some of these medications are just kind of there so that you can fit in. But what are you fitting into? Like, if you have instincts and your instincts are that working a job is boring, then maybe you should go find a different job. Why would you self-medicate? Why would you change your mental state of mind so that you can fit into what your brain is clearly telling you is not a good fit for your skill set? And I live my life that way. You know what I mean? Like, I've worked terrible jobs. I've worked in spreadsheets. And I just know, like, you kind of have a personal guide of your energy level, that sometimes you do things and it really excites you. And that's kind of like a guide, like, hey, this gives me more energy. I should be doing more of that. And then other things really sap you of your energy. And like, what makes Doug so great to me is not only are his jokes funny, but there's just some real, like, I personally pick my head up. I'm like, oh my God, this guy's actually saying something. There's some insight in here in terms of what made that funny. But if you have a commentary first, I feel like I'm over talking a little bit here.
Well, no, I mean, I like that. And that's why I wanted you to come on here. So don't feel shy about doing that. But yeah, so a few things there. My reaction to that is, you're right. I hadn't heard that one before. That bit from him. And so, yes, at first I thought it was just one thing. And then, yeah, the more it went on, the more I was like, oh, okay. And I liked it because by him tying it into, like, the, you know, the corporate structure, and so it didn't come off as a merely ideological, hey, I'm a libertarian, I don't like the state. You know what I mean? Like, it did sound more like it was an artist commenting on the world, you know? So, you know, I don't know if I'm getting my point across, but I think a lot of people who aren't card-carrying libertarians, if they hear too explicitly ideological objections about, like, they kind of shut down because they feel like there's an agenda here.
Right.
You know, like, oh, you guys think that big business is great and it's all the government's fault. Like, with the housing crisis, you just think, oh yeah, it's all the government's fault and the, you know, the particular loan programs and things. It's Fannie and Freddie, but you don't think that the banks were doing predatory pricing, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so I try to, you know, when I'm talking to a mixed crowd, especially, I try to make them, you know, realize that, of course, certain big companies did bad things here. The issue is, why would you bail them out? Like, you know, the way, you know, that's a bad system, that kind of thing. So that's why I like what he did there, is he wasn't just complaining about the government. He was, you know, there's doctors involved, there's big pharma, you know what I mean? So I thought that was pretty good. It is interesting how there's different drugs that, you know, are different. Like, clearly, alcohol is more destructive than marijuana. Like, on any metric you can pick, in terms of if you were gonna regulate something or ban it because, oh, it's harmful to society. And so, in trying to understand that, you know, I have long thought it's partly because, you know, alcohol. Tell me if I'm being too conspiratorial. It's kind of, yeah. The analogy I'm going to draw, not the analogy, but the other thing I'll mention is, I used to think it was just quote conspiracy theorizing when people would say stuff like, oh, in the schools, you know, when the government got its hands on the curriculum, they got rid of philosophy. They got rid of, you know, how to think, but they stress, like, the STEM stuff. You know how that's always a big thing, you know, the science and math and engineering and stuff like that. And we got to, in technology. So we're losing ground to China. Their math scores are through the roof, and we need to get more women into math. And so I've heard some observers pointing out, yeah, if you're running the show, if you're part of the ruling elite, you need people to be able to fix the planes. You don't want the plane falling out of the sky, because what good is it to rule a country if you might have a plane crash? So you need to have smart people, but you don't want them being philosophical. You don't want them stepping back and looking at the big picture and saying, wait a minute, what are we doing here? You just want them to be competent to go in and give you heart surgery. You don't want them to step back and be like, does the government have any role in, you know, like, why can't we sell our kidneys? You know, that kind of thing. Like, so that's,
I don't have a problem.
So to me,
with
that's part. Well, right. So
not only do I not have a problem with that, but just to kind of prove your point, firstly, is I remember my textbooks in high school, and they were all about the New Deal and how the Roosevelts and these people came in and saved our country from the Depression. And I mean, you'd be the expert on why that's complete, you know, that's complete malarkey. That's a farce, and that's propaganda. But not only is it propaganda, you read in the newspaper, I like down in Texas, I mean, the government is, there's a fight going on about, like, to what, like, taking evolution out of the school books, or whether or not you can say, like, So it's a very open discussion about the fact that government has an influence about what and won't be taught in your textbooks. So to go a step further and go that, you know, the people who are kind of deciding the coursework, you know, it's just, it's not a crazy thought. It's clear. It's very clear to me that my textbooks were like oddly, you know, leftist. I left high school thinking the progressives were here. Taft was a fat guy who sat in a bathtub. Conservatives are just trying to keep us from change. And thank God for the progressives because they were able to bring us all this incredible change to our country. We need more leftists. And I'm just going to root for progressive causes because those are the guys who have brought change. What a warped and terrible perspective. But it was propaganda. That's what it is.
Right.
So, you know, to your point, it's very clear that there are school boards and people who are making decisions about what is and what isn't taught in school. And to think that at some level, someone's not pushing some kind of an agenda is just crazy.
Yeah, so that's great that clearly, you know, we have example after example. And you're right. It's not just libertarian anti-government types who could say this. But a lot of people, you know, can clearly say, oh, there's an agenda with the intelligent design movement and they're trying to push creationism and I've read from standard biologists, you know, that sort of, you know, quote, conspiracy theorizing, and they even have memos from people inside the ID movement. And by the way, folks, remember, I'm going to come back and revisit these topics down the road here. So it's true that they could not possibly say the very notion that there are some people who are actively trying to change school curricula to serve some ulterior motive is absurd, because a lot of them think that themselves about people they disagree with and they're afraid of, or, you know, like the uncoke my campus groups, you know, they clearly think there's a shadowy group of billionaires trying to totally, you know, take over the country via indoctrination. It's just, they think it's the Koch brothers and their, you know, free market agenda. So, but more specifically on this one, the thing that I wasn't as sure about, now I am coming more around and agreeing, is this idea of the schools don't teach you how to think. They just give you a bunch of facts and particular skills. My roommate in college, I think it was in an English class. I don't know why. I'm forgetting what kind of class it was, but he got up and he had to go through a demonstration to the class as to the difference between an argument ending with a true conclusion and the argument being valid or not, and how those were different things. And so he was saying, you know, if I say, 2 + 2 = 4, and therefore the sun is hot, that's not a valid argument,
right?
Even though the premise is true and the conclusion is true. And then he did another example where if the premise had been true, then if Socrates were immortal, then Socrates would still be alive.
Right.
But Socrates isn't, you know, so it's a valid argument. It's just the premise, you know, that kind of thing. He was walking through those sorts of things. And I mean, it wasn't like everyone was throwing stones at him. It's like, what are you doing? We all knew this in sixth grade. They're all like, oh yeah, yeah, I get what you're saying. And the professor even thanked him, like, oh, very good, Steve. Thank you for clarifying. And I was like, what the heck is that? but it is true. And so then I noticed that, you know, I don't want to make more of this than it is, but I mean, on Twitter and like when I argue, I realize it's pointless to argue with people when they don't even know they've lost the argument. Like, and they're not lying. Like,
right.
I believe them. They don't see how I just blew them up. They really don't see it because they don't know how to, they just know, no, I have this particular view of the world, and like an argument bounces off of them. And that to me is like, how could you possibly make progress with that? You know, you can send them any information you want, but if they don't even know what a good argument is, how could you possibly discover the truth?
Yeah, I think to speak to that point, I think that's where the sales and the marketing people kind of need to step in and go, hey, people are making emotional decisions. And while like you, me, Dave, or a lot of the libertarians, we're kind of like these, we've come to this because of logic or because we're interested in logic and we go, hey, I think this is the best way to live. And people are more emotional. They're dumb. They're not making decisions in the same way that we are. I think you give them too much credit for being rational. And so it's almost like we got to redesign things to win people over on the emotional front. You know what I mean? It's like at the end of the day, you can have the world's greatest product, but if you can't sell it, you're going to go out of business. So I think that's kind of, sometimes it's like you got to kind of alter the approach and realize like we really like logic, but not everyone else does. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. So you have to deal with the hand you're dealt.
Yeah.
So I agree. It's not enough just to sit back and lament and say, well, if people were more rational, we'd be winning. That's not what I'm saying, but this is all tied to, in case it didn't make clear, to Stanhope's bit there about how, you know, which drugs are pushed and which ones are forbidden.
Oh yeah, it's
and
cultural.
I'm saying, yeah, part of what he's getting at there is the drugs that would like turn you into a free thinker and to really question deep thoughts and stuff like that. That's the stuff that gets swept under the rug, whereas it's the ones that just, oh yeah, go out and have a good time and, you know, go get hammered and take some chick home, you know, that kind of, like that, you're not going to start a revolution with that kind of a, that's a distraction. Whereas, you know, other types of drugs might make you more philosophical. You might go be reading something and be like, oh, wow, I really, you know, it's like, man, maybe taxation is theft. Whoa, yeah. You know, that kind of thing. Also on that, it just popped into my head. The guy, John Nash, the Nobel Prize winning, he was a mathematician, but he got an economics for game theory.
Yeah.
They made the Russell movie about him, right? Movie.
Yeah, A Beautiful Mind. Yeah, Russell Crowe. Like, I'm horrified, stupefied, terrified by you. That one. In his, they quoted, I read like the actual, like, I think it was Sylvia Nassar, if I'm saving the name right, the book upon which the movie was based. And they asked him at one point, because, you know, he, believe it or not, the movie downplayed just how, you know, off the deep end he went. Like, he went into the faculty lounge. I forget where it was. He at Princeton? I forget where. I think it was at Princeton. And he would throw like the New York Times down, you know, on the table in front of the other professors. And they'd be like, hey, John, what's up? And he'd say, hey, you see that headline right there? You know, pointing to that day's newspaper. And they'd say, yeah. He said, that's aliens communicating with me. He could have been, yeah. And so, you know, after he starts getting treatment and everything, and they asked him, you know, John, didn't, you know, couldn't you kind of, you know, did you have, I'm paraphrasing, but along the lines of, you're a very smart guy. You know, some people get delusional. Couldn't you recognize that these thoughts you were having were, you know, clearly couldn't be? And he said something like, well, the mental experience and the sensation by which I came up with those later ideas was the same thing that allowed me to win the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, he's saying like, because, and that's the thing, it's for people who don't know his work, but I mean, it wasn't like he just took some unsolved problem from some previous economists or mathematicians and tweaked it and did something. Like, he just came at it in a totally new approach. You know what I mean? It was like, whoa, okay, yeah, if you wanted, I mean, so it was real out of the box thinking. And so it's the kind of thing where either, oh, that's stupid, nobody cares, or it's brilliant. It was right. One of those things in terms of his contribution. And so, in fact, the thing that he won the Nobel Prize for, the story goes, he originally showed it to this other guy, John von Neumann, who was also a, you know, huge gun. And he just looked and said, oh, this is just a fixed point theorem. Like, in other words, he was just saying, this is stupid. Whereas that's the thing that economists were like, oh, he started a whole new field of, you know, he revolutionized game theory with this new concept of Nash equilibrium. So anyway, his point was, why would I dismiss this stuff? Because earlier in my life, this same feeling of, wow, I'm coming up with thoughts that nobody else has thought of before. Maybe I should write this down. And he's getting accolades and everyone's saying what a genius he is. And then later he starts thinking, like you said, what if aliens were communicating with him through the headlines, you know? So anyway, it was a similar thing. It just Stanhope's routine there kind of reminded me of that.
No, I get that. Perception is reality. And if you're the guy who gets a Nobel Peace Prize, you like just keep thinking you're onto something. I get that. Going full circle, though, what makes that bit funny? So firstly, it perks me up where I'm like, oh, my God, he's actually talking about something. This is really profound. But then he hits like a perfect impression of a lady kind of describing her experience of being medicated. But then he kind of puts into her mouth the unintended consequences as if that's what she's going for. But he's kind of created a framework where there's really no other way than to kind of understand that when you're taking medication, you're doling out your brain's disposition. You know what I mean? Like, he's kind of built his lot, like, we're now, you're in a, you kind of can't deny that frame where it's like, yeah, I'm taking a pill so that if I'm working a job, I can be better at that job without questioning, well, maybe I should be doing something else. But then it becomes very funny because he's like, you know, I might be the most boring person I know, but I'm getting so much done. I'm just sorting these insurance forms, which is, here's the other thing with it's all about the specifics. Sorting insurance forms is such a great specific because we can all sit there and go, that is the worst job in the world. I would never want to do that. And yes, it's funny that someone would take a medication so that they could do the world's worst job faster and more efficiently and then take pride in the fact that they're doing it faster and more efficiently. He pegged the perfect, I might be the most boring person I know, but I take that out and I can just sort through insurance forms. I don't even know what I'm doing. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. It's perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. This is, again, the thing we alluded to earlier about you have the premise, but then you do some real specific illustration. in order to really drive the point home. And that's what somehow turns it from being an interesting, perhaps deep observation about reality into, oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
All right. If we can, with your permission, I don't want to keep you too long, but I do want to ask you a little bit more about how did you... So of course, you know, we focused on comedy, but you also are a... What are you a co-host of Part of the Problem, or are you more of a sidekick?
I think Dave is very nice and he'll call me the co-host. I think sidekick is probably more applicable.
Can I tell you the joke that I said? Because now that I didn't want to open up with this but now we're more friends. You know, I'm not. I'm just trying to be funny. So Tom Woods had his, was it 1,000th episode? He had something in Florida where it was some milestone of the Tom Woods show. And he threw a big party for himself and had all kinds of people come in. And I was supposed to go, and there was going to be a roast at the, or there was a roast at the end.
Right.
Okay. And then, and so Dave went and other people were there and I was supposed to go, but then there was a hurricane or something and it got postponed and I couldn't make the new date. So I wasn't there. So they still went ahead with the roast. And so Dave had already prepared some material making fun of me, you know, so he gets up there and, you know, stuff like, even though Bob Murphy's sitting on his fat ass, he's still performing human action. You know, that kind of, you know, it was okay. An Austrian thing. But
yeah.
The punchline is that, you know, I'm apparently I'm above optimal weight for my height. I don't know where he's getting that from. And so, you know, so that's the deal. And so I, of course, didn't. And so then on the Contra Cruise that where Dave, you know, was shortly going to be on as one of our guests there, part of what we did the end of the week is I got up and answered because Tom was making fun of me, too.
Okay.
And so, you know, they're roasting me and I'm not even there to defend myself. So I got up and said, no, I had material, folks. And so then I went into it and I started zinging them. And so, yeah, one of the things I said about Dave was like, you guys listen to Part of the Problem. And they all, oh, yeah. They said, Dave's got, you know, he's got this great guy who's with him on the show, Robbie the Fire. He doesn't get to speak much. I said something like, in terms of a sidekick who never gets to talk, Robbie is the Tonto of libertarian podcasts. And it, nothing. And I don't know. So I'm curious. I couldn't tell. Is it because, you know, maybe I was nervous and I said it fast and they didn't even hear? Do they not know the Lone Ranger and Tonto? Or did they not listen to Dave enough? So technically they didn't even get the premise that, no, he's got someone that I feel, you know, doesn't get to talk as much as he should. So anyway, I don't know. But in any event, I still at night sometimes wonder why didn't that joke work better?
I think he had a good joke structure there. I think Tonto was just the wrong reference.
But who else? So I would have had just to think of a different.
I mean, we could brainstorm it out loud, but the joke again was in terms of podcast host.
I said in terms of a sidekick who never gets to talk, Robbie is the Tonto of libertarian podcasts.
Robbie's the Tonto. I'd have to think.
Because to me, maybe
That's part of it. Because to me, the only thing is Tonto just sits there, Kimosabi.
Yeah.
And the Lone Ranger is the star, and all Tonto does is just sit there like, you know.
You calling me Tonto? I'm done with the show, Bob Murphy. I'm out. We were having fun, but if you're calling Tonto jokes on me,
yeah. Now,
if this were on Twitter,
people would be like, but Robbie's not Indian? Is this an Elizabeth Warren reference?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't get it, you know?
Like, no, that's not the joke. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, but in all seriousness, like it's, there are stretches where Dave just goes off and I'm wondering, like, does he hit a button and the sign in the back says, hold your...
Oh, you know, no, not
like,
at all.
Now you can talk.
Oh, that's fair. I would say...
I'm kidding, but...
No. I get where you're coming from. No, what you're more seeing... I see it... I'm on Dave's show. It's Dave's show and I'm really happy to be there. And sometimes I just don't have the expertise on some of these topics. I don't have a lot to add, so I'm happy to kind of sit back and let him do his thing. And I think that's what makes me good on the show is I can kind of recognize, oh, Dave's doing his thing right now. Let's not interrupt it. And then other topics, when you hear me more engaged, it's just because I know more about it and I have more to say. So I would say that's to my credit what makes me good on the show with him is I can just kind of recognize, like, I could interrupt him. He's never been like, hey, you're interrupting me too much. Or he's never given me a signal of, hey, don't. But like, if I'm being quiet, it's like I can usually either I have absolutely nothing to add and you guys are just giving me too much credit that I would if he gave me the opportunity. Or I can kind of recognize he's doing his thing. So that's why sometimes I sit back.
And let me say, I mean, this is going to sound like I'm just trying to make sure I don't hurt your feelings.
Oh,
I'm being dead serious.
Yeah.
You do play an indispensable role because...
it's much better that you guys are talking to each other. And then if Dave wants to go on a rant about Yemen or something, he has the freedom to do that. But it really helps that it's not just Dave talking to the audience. Like, hey, I want to talk, you know, Joe Biden's back in the news. And let me, like, you guys go. And then some of your best, you know, most entertaining things are where, yeah, you'll bring up one premise, like we said earlier, about the, you know, have to prove to the judge you're lazy. Yeah. And then you and Dave just kept one-upping each other about how would you actually prove it? It got, you know, it got a little bit beyond the etiquette for the Bob Murphy show. But, you know, things like that, or you guys start doing when you were doing recently, you were doing your impressions of, you know, like he did his Obama, like talking about Joe Biden and yeah. You know, whether hugging girls was appropriate and stuff. And then you were doing were you doing Bernie Sanders?
I do a pretty good Bernie Sanders.
You guys were going back and forth. You were doing Bernie Sanders. I mean, it was – that would not have happened. And certainly if Dave had just been talking, it would have been weird and forced and affected if he just decided to go into a Bernie Sanders impression where you – like you put it on the table and you guys just started – so anyway, I'm being dead serious. It really is a much better thing and I'm – so I wonder, you know, do you go watch old Ed McMahon clips and take notes? Like, how do I do this? How do I
be a better lump on a log?
Yeah.
The Carson show is a little bit before my time, but I know that was always the running gag, particularly because I've definitely watched Don Rickles go on there and just, he was always giving a tough time to Ed McMahon. So yeah, that's definitely the old format.
Did you ever see that? Yeah. And I didn't know that many of them too, but like, did you watch Saturday Night Live when it would be Dana Carvey doing Johnny Carson? And
I
Phil
was not
Hartman
a Saturday
doing...
Night Live fan. It just never.
Okay.
Yeah, I know how much that show means to people, and I mean the talent that's come out of there, and I loved afterwards is unbelievable. But I never had a stretch of life where I was like, I got to see Saturday Night Live. It just was not. I don't know. It was never a thing to me.
Mm-hmm. So, did you ever secretly hope that like one day you're going to get in the Gas Digital studio and Dave's going to call and be like, "Yeah, my kid's sick. I can't make it," and then they're like, "Robbie, it's up to you. You got to do it." It's like all about Eve, and you just take off.
Zero interest. I literally can't do what Dave does. It's not like I'm happy to I'm happy to sit there and bring my kind of stupidity. And the other thing this is the other thing that's really fun about Dave is, I mean, he's passionate and he's knowledgeable, and I'm kind of riding his wave of the interest and knowledge that he brings. But if I had to be the initial source on that, it'd be a nightmare. I can't do what he does. So no, like if Dave doesn't show up, we're not having an episode, or okay, we got to line up a good guest.
But what happened? But it is true that what you do, a lot of times he'll say, "Oh no, Robbie, you sent me this clip," and yeah, I thought, "Oh, we got to talk about this." So you do sometimes like get the raw material to be the fuel for the episode.
Yeah. And also we've definitely when Dave was having the baby, sometimes if Dave is more preoccupied, then there's more of an opportunity, I guess, for me to come up with what the source material for the show would be. Basically what happens is, I guess a little bit of how the show is made, but I mean, we do it on Mondays and Fridays live at Gas Digital Network on 6 p.m. But as I come across topics that I think would be a show fit, I email them to him, and every once in a while there's a hit.
Hey folks, let's take another pause in my conversation with Robbie the Fire. Later in this interview, you're going to see Robbie turns the tables and he starts asking me questions. You imagine this guy? Get a load of him. And what he wanted to know was my thoughts on the coming crash and the timing and what to invest in. And a lot of people have questions like that. And so let me just remind you, if you are a business owner, then Carlos Lara and I have a special seminar just for you. It's going to be on May 10th. This is 2019 in Nashville, Tennessee. There's only 25 slots, but as of this recording, there are still some available. And so you want to check that out. It's going to be me talking about the coming crash from an Austrian perspective. And Carlos is going to be focusing on how to use IBC, the infinite banking concept, as a way to manage your cash flow, particularly in this current environment. But it's also a more general strategy. So for more details, go to infinitebanking.org/bizowner, B-I-Z owner, all one phrase. infinitebanking.org/bizowner, or of course I can put a direct link at the show notes page. You're listening right now to episode 30. Okay, let me, if you got like another 10 minutes
I'm
or
hanging,
so
man.
Last thing I
no yeah, kids no
last
nothing.
Thing I wanted to, yeah, this is good. why is that, Rob? Let's
no,
talk
no, no,
about
not,
why
let's
don't
not,
you
yeah. Let's not do that topic.
your mom emailed me and she was like, she wanted to know, so what here's my premise. Here's the thing, and this is, I just want to throw out. I'm curious to get your reaction.
Yeah.
I am concerned. So it's very funny with AOC. That's just so we I don't leave people hanging in suspense here. I am concerned. Like, you know, there's all these memes going around showing her with, like, you know, catching her with big bug eyes, and she's got her mouth open, and, you know, she's got teeth that are above average size and stuff. Like, really dumb looking still shots, and then, you know, putting words in her mouth like she's standing outside of a Subway, you know, the sandwich shop.
Yeah.
And saying, I've been here for 3 hours. Where's the green line? You know, that kind right. of stuff. And I'm concerned, is the right wing, are they doing to her what the leftists thought? Oh, this guy, Donald Trump, is just an absolute buffoon. Let's just make sure everyone realizes how much of an idiot he is. And that will totally take him off the political scene. When in fact, that totally backfired. That the people who liked Trump hated the guts of the average person who was going to get up there and make sure you know. It's not merely that he has bad policies. Don't you know he's a racist? He's a misogynist? So I'm saying the kind of people that like AOC and elected her, aren't we almost making her immune to criticism with this over-the-top? That's my concern. So go, you get the premise. Yeah. What do you think?
It's worse than that. I'm a big fan of Scott Adams. I read his book, Trumped. I think it was called, no. Whatever it was a book about how Trump got elected. But he was talking about the amount of free publicity that Donald Trump got put him all in our minds, but it didn't just put him in his mind. Even if you're talking about it in a negative, even if you're talking about it in the negative and you go, this guy can never be president, you're still kind of putting the words president affiliated with Donald Trump, and it becomes more and more a reality the more and more you kind of see that repeated. So if you take someone like AOC and she kind of just went ignored, she's a low profile New York congressperson. I don't know most of people who are in Congress. Most of them are low profile. Who cares? She's been elevated to celebrity status. So like, even if she's celebrity status because a ton of people hate her or because she's this person who's an idiot, the more and more celebrity status someone has, the more like they're just like a home name where all of a sudden it's like, oh, like, I don't know. I'm Jimmy Kimmel. I got AOC on tonight. She's a get. You know what I mean? Like, all of a sudden you have, she now has celebrity status. Having celebrity status, that's like a star that grows where it's like everyone's attracted to you because you're winning and your name's in the news. Nobody cares about truth. Nobody cares about good ideas. And she's the most dangerous person in politics right now. If she had her way, she would kill us all. Let's get the word out there so everyone understands in no simple terms. If AOC had her way, we'll all be dead. I mean, read the Green New Deal. She wants to get rid of every building. She wants to get rid of fossil fuels. Like, I don't know where her socialism begins or ends, but I'm pretty sure that if you just put her in charge and she had her way, that'd be the end of us. We're done. So the answer is you're right. She has the Donald Trump factor that Donald Trump said things that were so weird and loony, you couldn't not report it. And the more and more you reported it, the more publicity you gave him and the more you actually put it into people's heads of, oh, this is the thing we should be focused on. Oh, this is the guy who could be president. You know what I mean? It's almost like you're putting the sale already into people's brains. So it's like if we all kind of stand around and go, AOC is a threat. Like if she becomes president, it's going to be a disaster. And people keep hearing AOC can't be president. People are going to start thinking, oh, this is a real possibility for president. You know, like we're actually, that's the sale. That's what we're going to start putting into every leftist mind of, oh, the enemy is so alarmed about AOC, she must be good. So yeah, I think you're 100% right. It's not, we'd be better off ignoring it if we could.
All right. So I have two responses. One thing I want to ask you though, before I forget, the very fact that we're calling her AOC, does that play into her hands? Cause it's like FDR and JFK, or is it just, you see what I'm saying? That decision that we've, because I don't know, I don't think it was a critic that came up with that. I'm imagining it was one of her fans that branded her AOC.
Yeah, so I'm going to go with, I've heard like for websites, you kind of just want to have like three letters because it makes it easier for people to remember and get to it. So yes, firstly, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Let's just understand that even though I don't think we live in a racist country, it's still, that's like a weird name. You know what I mean? Like it just kind of sounds, Ocasio, it's a lot. AOC, it's friendly, it's short, it's more easily recognizable. So yeah, we're not, I mean, there's no way around that. It's just the easier way of referring to her. But yeah, the fact that she's got an abbreviated nickname, it's a little bit stickier, which isn't good.
Okay, so does that mean then that, for example, someone like me, if I'm talking about her, I should try to go out of my way to refer to who as Alexander Ocasio-Cortez? Or do you think it's just like, yeah, in the grand scheme, it's probably not, but it's just so much easier to say AOC, forget it.
Yeah, no, I think it's just, it's AOC. It's just easier. But yeah, the fact that like that almost becomes like a Nike, it becomes a brand. Like she's now the brand right. of like the ultra leftist. And the fact that she's got the abbreviated thing probably, it, you know, gives it a little bit more brand appeal. But what the hell, what are we going to do about that?
Just think of it. Yeah, this just occurred to me. Because if you think about it, what you're doing when you say that, when you say AOC, you're communicating subconsciously to the audience, we know we're going to keep talking about her over the next years.
Yeah.
And so let's come up with a short, you know, whereas if it was just some, you know, some bus driver in Albuquerque who, you know, got arrested for a DUI and he had a long name, you wouldn't give him a nickname because, well, his name's, you would just, because we're going to say this guy's name once for this news story, never mention his name again. So there'd be no reason to come up with a nickname for him. So I think you're communicating she's a big deal. She's got staying power just by calling her AOC.
We could pull the Trump and start calling her Crazy Cortez or something, you know, come up with with the nickname so that everyone knows who we're talking about. Or I'm telling you, I'm starting in this movement. AOC, if she got her way, she'll kill us all. Let's get that out there. Even if it sounds crazy, it's true. But yeah, it is kind of our duty to get the other story out there. And she's dangerous, man. She is.
All right, let me push you back a little bit. I think you may have misunderstood what my initial question was with the premise. Okay. I'm not saying, should we talk about her or should we ignore her? More specifically, I'm saying the over-the-top mocking of her by inventing things she didn't actually say and then having memes going around with fake quotes attributed to her.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about. It's just I'm saying with the left. I'm not saying the left played into Trump's hands by criticizing him. Yeah. I'm saying by saying Russia collusion, he said the neo-Nazis were very fine people when he clearly said the exact opposite, when he specifically denounced them. That's what I'm talking about.
I agree with you. I think if you're being funny and mocking, like, great. You know, try and cut her down as much as you can. But no, I think that there's enough insanity coming from her that is legitimately dangerous. I'm not just like, I'm not like pulling an Alex Jones here and describing her as being dangerous, like in some extreme term. Like, no, her ideas, her literal ideas are very dangerous. There is no reason to affiliate conspiracies or anything that's not true with her, because what she's doing is already a threat to us. And so, yes, if we create fake threats and throw them out there and say that, like, I don't know, she said that we should, if you made something up, like whatever the hell it is, if you start making things up, yes, you're going to erode the value of being able to.
I'll give you an example.
So
for example, when the Green New Deal came out, all of it, like very soon after, a fake story, and they did a good job in terms of the forgery. They did like a screenshot of the, you know, the C drive or whatever that had the Word document or what, I forget what it was, but it was a weird thing. It wasn't like a PDF that was up on their site. It was some weird thing, like you almost thought you were getting a virus if you clicked on it. But the thing that had the FAQ for the Green New Deal, the stuff where it had the infamous thing about, you know, we can't get rid of airplanes and farting cows within 12 years or something, like that really was up there and they took it down. So that was official. But what gave – so what introduced some element of doubt was there were – and it was like – what's that guy's name? Mark Dice. I don't know if he invented it or just popped – but there were some – people circulating a thing where it said, we need people to recycle their urine. And they said, oh, and so what you do is you put it in a jar and put it in the fridge for up to 7 days to get rid of the pee odor. You know what I mean? And so it was, like I said, it was a good forgery. Like it looked like the same font and everything. And so people were circulating that. And so I'm saying that was funny. You know, you just laughed. It's funny. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, but I wondered, would that be bad? Because now when people are saying about the farting cows, because that was originally how Ocasio-Cortez's fans, or officially, they dealt with the stuff about, oh, you guys want to get rid of airplanes? And they said, no, that was a hoax. That's not up on our website, because they took it down. And since there really was a hoax that had been circulating that Fox News type people were spreading, I think her fans might have just believed, oh, yeah, all these crazy things I'm hearing, that's not what she meant. They're lying. Just like with Trump, he can just say fake news. So now even if they come out with, if they catch him on camera, you know, shooting somebody in the head, he can just say, no, that's CNN trying to frame me, just like they did with the Russia stuff. And his fans would be like, yeah, I don't trust CNN anymore because we've caught them lying about Trump so many times. I don't believe a word out of their mouth. And so that's what I'm wondering with her, with these, you know, real specific hoax things, fake quotes. Is that inoculating her against genuine criticism?
Yeah, so. Probably to some extent. I think there's enough crazy there and bad ideas that we could probably stick to the truth and even find ways to make that funny. That, like, her ideas were as insane as, you know, store your own urine and re-drink it. Like, so, yes, I agree with you. Probably not the best strategy.
And it is funny on that one. For some reason, I knew that the getting rid of farting cows and planes in 10 years, yeah, we'd like to, but it's just unfeasible. I knew that was a real quote, whereas the storing your urine for a week or whatever it was, I knew that was a hoax. And I don't know. I can't give more of a reason, but initially when I saw those, I just right away knew the one thing. Yeah, I could totally believe her staffers wrote that thing, but yeah. No, not the other one. I don't know. Maybe it's just I have an insight into the socialist Democrat's mind.
But. Bob Murphy knows urine. I've always said.
Let it not be said. All right. Can we, as we wrap up here, you mentioned before you guys have a tour upcoming. Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Let me plug a couple things. Got some big stuff coming up. Firstly, if you're not listening to Dave Smith's show, I mean, it's the best analysis weekly on whatever's going on in the news. I recommend that part of the problem. I also got my podcast. It's complete filth and lunacy. So if you're a legit good Christian out there who loves Bob Murphy for your Christianness, I don't know if I said that right. You might not appreciate it, but it's called Run Your
Some
Mouth.
Some people use the term Christianity.
But Christianity? Yeah. All right, that works too.
Yeah. that's the noun form. Yeah.
Check out Run Your Mouth. Sometimes we do some real journalism. At the moment, we're trying to interview anybody who has tried to start a small business and any kind of government policy that's gotten in the way of that. So the other week we talked to someone who wanted to grow CBD, but there were laws in the state that he lived that you had to basically devote a massive amount of acreage, pricing out small people from doing that. Next week, we got a lawyer who's coming on telling us a little bit about licensing laws. And if you're out there, I'd love to hear from you because a lot of times we talk about the big theories and I'd love to hear, you know, common day folk and what's going on that government's getting in the way of you being successful. We're also going to do the summer porch tour, which is when we go to our listeners' porches and we broadcast from there. And then lastly, check it out. Me and Dave, we're going to be on tour doing some stand-up, which that's really us at our best. I mean, you hear some podcasts and, you know, we're throwing out funny, but when you actually see us on stage, that's the crafted jokes and that's when that's where the real magic happens. So I definitely recommend coming out and, you know, checking out the tour. It's going to be fun.
All right. Well, thanks, Robbie the Fire, and your other nickname that's a little bit dirty
for being with us.
I seriously do appreciate it, and I think the people they learned some stuff about how comedy works. So thanks for joining us.
But before we close out, can I hit you with a question?
Sure.
All right. When's this collapse coming, and how much of my money should I have in gold? Like, what's the best hedge here? What should I be doing?
Okay, so the yield curve recently inverted, and so assuming that trend continues. I would be surprised if there's not a pretty big crash again, unless the Fed does like QE4, which, you know, could buy them some more time. But assuming they don't do something like that, yeah, I think within 12 to 18 months, you know, it's not just going to be conspiracy theories, libertarian type. Like, people are going to be, yeah, this is bad. The stock market will have come down significantly. And, you know, people will say that the recession is here. So that's in terms of timing, I think that's
12 to 8 months.
Now.
Yeah.
12 to 18 months. Yeah. Is what I think in terms of, I would be surprised if we went another 12 to 18 without it happening, even if the Fed just, you know, holds pat at this point, I would be surprised. So, and then I don't think it makes sense to say in terms of number of dollars, but yeah, in terms of
percentages,
your proportion like of stuff.
Yeah. What percentage of, if you wanted to just preserve your wealth, you're not even looking for return on investment. You just go, let's just say a number. I got 10 grand and I want this 10 grand to be worth 10 grand. You know what I mean? I don't want this to lose or erode all of its value. Is gold the way to go? Just put it all in gold or put, you know, 20% in gold?
28.7%.
That's the perfect hedge? Is it?
Yeah. I think, so again, folks, consult with your tax attorneys, consult your financial advisor. This is not official advice. I certainly have a bunch of gold. I also have silver coins. You know, that's
to me, those are interchangeable. If it's silver and gold, it's right, just, it's right. The precious metal play.
Well, but let me just, I mean, since you're asking though, but the reason I, especially for, you know, younger people who, you know, they don't have like hundreds of thousands of dollars, but it's just more like, I want to be able to, the reason I like things like, you know, quarters or dimes from
you know, before 1950 kind of thing, where you could just, you could go to some, a regular person and just say, look at, this is a U.S. quarter from 1928, right? And they go, yeah, go look up on the internet what the silver content is. And like everybody would know what that thing was. Whereas if you have, you know, even if it's American Eagle, but you know, gold coins are less recognizable as opposed to actual, you know, coins that are quarters and dimes and stuff that were issued before a certain date. So that's why I like those. I think that's, it'd be easier for you to find somebody in the post-crash world that would agree what that was. Whereas if you try to give them a gold coin, I think a smaller percentage of people would trust what that thing was. So that's my only point on that. Also, yeah, so I think in the crash situation, yeah, the gold and silver, we have to make two distinctions. So initially, it could be deflationary in the, and I'm using these terms colloquially, that you could see the dollar strengthen. So I could imagine the stock market tanking, real estate tanking, but people rushing to treasuries. That's what happened, you know, 2008, 2009. So there's that element. So I do think in the long run, the dollar is in trouble. But I could imagine this initially, the dollar strengthens paradoxically because everybody freaks out and they rush to treasuries thinking that's safe.
All right. Now, I'm talking over my head here, but I would think in a crash environment, though, if you don't have physical cash, is there a possibility for like a run on the banks or, you know, losing? Does that possibility exist? Like when you say your dollar's going to actually be, it's going to be deflationary and your dollar's going to go up in value, are you saying like my dollar in the bank, are you saying you have to actually be holding cash to get that return?
Okay, so good question. So I'm going to link folks and I'm going to send you to Rob. My co-author Carlos Lahr and I did a video a few years ago called How to Weather the Coming Financial Storm.
Oh, I like it.
And so there, yeah, so we went through and you're right because we were worried about multiple things. We're worried about the dollar possibly crashing, the banks having a run and, you know, there being bail-ins and stuff like that. And so what we, and also just a general economic crash. And so those are three separate things. So you're right. We had a three-pronged strategy of having actual currency, you know, getting a safe or something at home, like having actual, you know, $100 bills on hand because the banks might close for a while. Also having dollar denominated assets. So we were recommending life insurance and we give specifics about how to do that because in case, you know, there is it's just a regular general crash where stocks and real estate fall, but the dollar strengthens, but the infrastructure's up and running. So that's the point of that. But then, yes, in case it's even worse and the dollar itself crashes, that's what we also recommended, gold. Also, for people who are technologically savvy, I'm imagining Bitcoin in the scenario where the dollar itself crashed, I'm imagining if you held Bitcoin, that would be good for you as well. So there's that element, but I will send you that.
All right, cool, man.
There's different, yeah, there's distinct things, but yes, there's
12 to 18 months
playing defense
and load up on gold. That's what I'm taking. 30%. I know you said 28.9, but I'm just rounding up at this point, keeping it simple.
Yeah. And of course, for everyone, that was a joke with the specificity.
Oh, no, I was taking that for real.
Yeah. No, well, okay.
I was going to call a guy up and go, hey, I need 28.9% of my wealth in gold. What can you do for me?
Yes. Okay. But I mean, yes, it's, again, it depends. But yeah, well, I'll send you that. For me, Robbie, I would think it would be more thinking in terms of months worth of expenses. Like that's what we recommended. In other words, just to make sure you don't get completely wiped out in terms of, you know, what are my monthly expenses?
Right.
And then like if I wanted enough gold, so once things shifted, could I survive for, you know, 3 months until things kind of recalibrated? You know, that kind of thought process.
I just don't want to lose, like, I don't want to invest. I don't want to lose wealth. Here's my last question for you. In your opinion of inflation, let's say take a 10-year perspective. So instead of a yearly loss, let's say I'm just holding all my money in cash. In your opinion, every 10 years, how much value am I losing?
I don't want to do exponentiation here at the end of a podcast episode.
Well, because even if you took their perspective of 2%, so every 10 years I've lost 20% of my wealth if I'm just holding everything as a pile of cash. But I'm going to assume that don't think it's 2%.
It's technically more, though.
Oh, because with the time value of money, I got you. Yeah.
Well, it's just compound interest.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Right? It's the compounding interest of every year of losing wealth. It's like the reverse of TVM.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, so there's that element. And also, as you know full well, the official price inflation numbers are goofy. So, right. And that's the difficulty right now, that to be safe, you know, you would want to get out of the stock market and real estate and put it into something. But yeah, if you just put it into treasuries or something or cash or under your mattress that
you're losing money.
Yeah, that stuff is growing. So it's tricky for me to say, because right now the next 10 years I think it's very uncertain what's going to happen, and partly because I'm not just being evasive. It really depends what the Fed does. So my guess is they can't just keep announcing rounds of QE. I think before they start another massive bond buying program, they would have to let there be a pretty big crash to justify that. Also, I mean, I think they don't want Trump to get reelected. So to the extent that we think there are people behind closed doors smoking cigars, wouldn't they let there be a crash, you know, going into the next election? How do you feel about that?
I agree with you. And I think it's the worst part of the whole thing, that if you're trying to forecast, that the element that you're considering is what will the Fed do, which is just not the way the market's like. That's the outrageous thing of this whole, is that it's not a question of real finance or real money or it's all a question. It's a gamble against what's this irrational player going to do. It's annoying, you know, but I could complain about this forever. I'm a Jew and they're taking my money. I don't like it.
You just reminded me. I had forgotten. I was listening to you and Dave talk.
I'm sure I got it all wrong.
No, that was good. But I was at the laundromat and I had the car door open and I was like sorting stuff because I had like my, you know, clothes were in the dryer or something. So I was killing time. And I had my car door open and you guys were playing, you know, on the car. And I was moving stuff around my car. I was getting ready to go to the post office or something. And so I don't use stamps.com, by the way. I'm the guy that drives back and forth and wastes time at the post office. And there were like people on the
church.
I don't know if it was a homeless guy, but they weren't church, but there was just some guy. He was like, they were looking in the dumpster or so. I don't know what they were doing, but there were people there who could clearly hear, you know, you guys talking. And it was when you were talking about the Fed and about the people who were making fun of Herman Cain and Steve Moore's, you know, them being there. And you just matter of fact, you know, you're doing monster and you just matter of factly, you know, in your deadpan thing said something like, and plus, I mean, you know, the people should be against the Fed because they're all Jews, right? And he goes, oh, yeah. They're all, and I was like, geez, you got, you know. So for folks at home, Dave and Robbie are Jewish. And so that's why they're allowed to talk like that. But here I am doing my, you know, so these guys looking, and, you know, and I had to get my car and drive away because now they're like, oh, there's some neo-Nazi sitting here doing his laundry. So I often find driving around campus, if I have my windows down and there's students out and I have your guys' pocket, I have to roll up the windows because you might say something very quickly before I have time. Like, you know, you don't give any warning that you're about to say something
insane.
You know, a little bit naughty.
Yeah. What an honor.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Robbie. This was great fun and good luck with everything. And we'll maybe have you back on later when we have more specificity about your tour dates.
Absolutely. Love it. Thanks so much for having me. This was great.
And thanks, everybody, and we will catch you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.